to the top song. The group is called Chevelle. Now, if you wondered how the band got their name, it's because the group members have always had a passion for fast cars. And Joe Loeffler's dad's favorite was, of course, the Chevy Chevelle. And Nikki, you've got one.
I got one. I love it. It's fast, just like this song, Face to the Floor. This is Chevelle at number one for 9 straight weeks. Let's do this. On the top spot, 9 weeks for Chevelle with Face to the Floor. We'll be back next week with more of the biggest songs in rock.
And don't forget, if you want to win an iPad from TurboTax, head on over to the Sideshow Countdown to enter. That's thesideshowcountdown.com.
We're going to give away 6 iPads. Good luck. I'm Nikki Sixx.
I'm Carrie Kasem.
And we'll see you here next weekend.
The Sideshow is now over. Go ahead. Stick a golden fork in it. We're done.
Now.
101 WRIF and WRIF HD1 Detroit.
Welcome to WRIF's award-winning Night Call, Detroit's longest-running phone-in talk show with Peter Werby and Jolene Jordan. Peter and Jolene will be voicing their opinions, and they want to hear yours. Call them at 313-298-WRIF. That's 313-298-9743. Now, here are Peter and Jolene.
Thank you very much. Welcome, everyone. Hi, Jolene.
Hello, Peter. Good to be here.
Yeah, another great week, another great weekend. I didn't do anything.
You didn't?
I don't think so. Oh, yeah, I went down to the Detroit Institute of Arts. You know, the Friday music program.
Free.
Free.
Yeah, free parking and everything. Did you know that?
Where's free parking? Never mind. We'll talk about it now. Hey, this is a talk show, WRIF's public affairs program. So it involves you directly. Usually you can call 313-298-WRIF and make a request for all the riff, rock, and roll.
Right.
But between 11 o'clock and 1 a.m. Sunday nights, Monday morning, you get to call up and give your opinion.
Yes, absolutely. And we're kind of like a morning show, like Drew and Mike are a talk show, but we're a whole nother set of topics.
Yeah,
say.
Exactly.
A little more on the political side.
What was I listening to Drew and Mike, and I was going, oh, are they really talking about this?
They said, think it out
they
there,
were.
Man.
Yeah. 313-298-9743 if you don't have letters on your telephone. If you'd like to email us, and boy, did I get a long email. We did, Jolene. Let me see. You know what? How am I operating this thing? We got too much going. Anyway, from our friend, the Canadian labor activist, Kathy.
Oh, yes, sure.
And she had this enormous long email about the Ontario Labor Day of Action, apparently, which was yesterday. But since we are in a different country, you know, we didn't hear about it. But so I thought, well, we could get her to call in, right? Except she said she's going to bed. She's going to have to listen to the podcast.
Okay. That's
which is
all right.
Which
well,
is good to do.
We'll
and
the talk
podcast,
to you then, Kathy.
Yeah, the podcast is will be up at noon tomorrow. Thank you, Sarah, and probably Athena as well. And by the way, we also, if I could find this, oh, I know where this email is. There you go. Thank you to Cody. Cody called in to just giving you guys an update on the two internet bills, SOPA and PIPA, which
yeah.
is save.
Well, that's Kate Middleton's sister.
Is it? Who?
PIPA.
Oh, is it? Protect the IP Act and Stop Piracy Act. And they've been withdrawn. I mean, there was so much incredible activism on the part of the online community.
Yeah,
if I would have, you know, all these sites just put up sort of black banners saying contact your congressperson and all that, and I didn't know how to do it with my site.
Yeah.
So
well,
I
you can explain it a little bit, you know, with SOPA, it has to do with the internet and
right.
the government and
right.
how the government wanted to be able
control.
To just come in and shut down your website if they don't like your content.
Well, they were saying it wasn't that blatant.
Yeah.
But people, you know, they get their foot in the door and something that's freewheeling. You know, it's all about stopping that free interchange of ideas. Are there abuses? Sure. But I think the freedom of exchange makes it well worth it. Some people that found out that it wasn't were the people from Mega Upload. Did you
no.
see in the run by a guy named Kim.com?
No.
You didn't see this?
No, I missed this entirely.
Well, Mega Upload is what they call a storage locker. So you can take any kind of material, put it in the storage locker, and then other people can download. You upload it to that.
Oh, okay.
And then it's downloaded there. Well, people were doing like tons of movies and songs and all that.
Yeah.
So the Kim, .com, he changed his name to .com. Are you calling me?
He really did.
What?
He changed his name to Kim.com.
Yeah, I forgot it. I think it was Kim Schmidt.
That's like the guy who changed his name to Santa Claus. Remember that one?
No.
Oh, yeah.
But anyway. So, Tim.com made so much money. They had photographs of his house. Looked like one of these, like, 20,000-foot mansions.
Uh-huh.
And a huge maze. You know, those things made out of bushes where you can't find your... there's trails, but you can't find your way
like
out.
Oh, yeah, like in the movie The Shining.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. So you know, you could claim, all right, and the government of the U.S. and of New Zealand, he was arrested in New Zealand, they claim that he was responsible for denying the proper owners of the intellectual property upwards towards $500 million.
Okay.
And this guy has made a fortune.
Yeah, well,
yeah.
So I don't think they're going to, he's probably got it in the Cayman Islands by now.
Yeah, like
just
Romney.
Just like Mitt Romney.
Just like
right.
Mitt Romney.
Yeah, yeah.
Which all leads us to, oh man.
The circus.
Oh, no. You know, one of the things, you went to college.
I graduated from college.
Did you live in a dormitory?
You know, I did for one long semester.
I mean, were you up at 2 in the morning when you were a freshman? Fresh person?
I am now. What do you mean?
You're a freshman again, yeah.
Yeah.
But you know, one of the things you talk about is, what is reality?
Yeah, man. Deep.
Deep stuff, right? And particularly when you're a sophomore, that's why they call things sophomoric. I mean, Gaia bless all you sophomores, high school and college. I'm not trying to. But, you know, what is reality? Well, I mean, it's a complicated.
What is reality?
Yeah, it's a
complicated. It depends on your reality.
Well, if you really get into the philosophical stuff, it is pretty complicated.
Yeah.
But in terms of, I mean, all right, this is real. People listening to this is real. I'm real. You're real.
We're talking. That's real.
Yeah, that's real. But when you start getting into the media, right?
Yeah.
And the media is plural for medium.
Sure.
So it's a step between reality and, between the
perception.
Yeah, it's between the person that is doing the communicating and the person that's receiving the communication.
That's true, which is always a very different thing.
Yeah, and you can, as people that have been in media all our lives, we can choose what people hear, right?
Yes.
So what the media has chosen for us is this damn primary season of these Republicans!
It's been a real freak show. And the South Carolina one just takes the cake, doesn't it? Newt Gingrich kind of running away. Not covering, he ran away with that sucker. But that's also South Carolina. I mean, there are a lot of reasons that he got it. It's a very evangelical state.
Two-thirds of the people are like teabaggers.
Oh, yeah.
But you know what kills me? For one thing, all of these rallies, they all look like Klan rallies, you know? Are there any black people in the world or brown people or yellow people?
Not that like Newt Gingrich.
Or red people?
Yeah, really.
What are any other colors? But they're all gone. And so they always talk about the South Carolina voters or the New Hampshire voters or the Iowa voters. They're not, I mean, that is imprecise. They are Iowa or New Hampshire or South Carolina or Florida Republicans.
That's right.
Yeah. So what we're doing is getting this peek into the inside mechanism of how these people choose their candidates, and who cares?
Well, I think no matter who it is in the end, Newt or Romney, they're not going to beat Obama.
No, I don't think so.
I hope Newt gets in there into the nomination, because then it's really hands down.
Well, you know, this is terrible that some people are actually, that aren't Republicans, that are planning to vote in the Michigan Republican primary.
Yeah.
Like me.
Yeah, I know. Well, you know, you needed to get with me earlier on that one. I would have done it.
Well, you can still do it.
I can?
Well, yeah. The when is it? I don't know, April or something.
And
like
then I just have to switch my affiliation.
You don't have
back.
To switch it. You just ask for a ballot. Which ballot do you want? You can say, I want a Republican or a Democrat.
Okay.
Or none. Yeah. So you could either vote for Newt Gingrich, figuring he's the easiest target, right, for Obama.
Mm-hmm.
Or you could vote for Ron Paul, because although half of or more of what he believes in is just this insane right-wing John Birch Society, you know, abolish Medicare and Social Security and throw grandma out on her own and conspiracies and gold standards and anti-Semitism and, you know, racism, everything. Well, they're all running this racist crap. I mean,
they really are.
For sure. But then Ron Paul, as we say, does have some good things on foreign policy, civil liberties.
The drug war.
The drug war.
As far as it goes, he wants to close all the bases around the world.
So,
beautiful. Love it. Love it, Ron.
So as people who hope all of them disappear into a big hole that opens in the earth, who would we vote for?
I think, I would say Newt Gingrich.
Well, let's put that out there. 313-298-WRIF.
313-298-974. It's all a 9743. It's all a tactic.
Yeah,
it's a tactic.
All right. So as a liberal, as a Democrat, as a leftist, as a socialist, as a centrist, and this is all who's kind of grouped in the Democratic Party, around a center-rightist president. Now, that's what Obama is. He's not a center-leftist. He's certainly not a leftist. There's nothing that has anything to do with Barack Obama and socialism.
He's a corporatist.
Yeah, at all. Right. But so if you want to screw up the Republican Party, or you want to make some points, who would it be better to vote for? Newt Gingrich or Ron Paul? Because Mitt Romney? Willard Romney? I mean, come on. That's Mr. 1%.
Totally.
He is the one. And he says, I don't want to divide this up into classes. No wonder, Mick.
Of course you don't.
Because you're the 1% and all the rest of us are.
That's his way of saying, could we just avoid that whole thing? Well, Florida's next. But the thing is, Florida is much more liberal than South Carolina. I mean, it's more liberal. So I'm saying that Romney is probably going to get that one, you know, just based upon religion.
Who knows?
You know, well, those folks in South Carolina didn't want to vote for a Mormon.
Now, one of the things that's happening, and no one will, of course, no one on the right, no one in the Republican Party is going to say, yeah, we're racist and we don't like Barack Obama because he's colored. You know,
They're not going to admit it.
They're not going to say that. They're going to say, no,
do
no.
They still say colored? My God.
I kind of like that.
Century!
Yeah,
century
what
century
check. Is it? Right, right. But that's what they're all about. They're all giving these racial signals. And, of course, the worst is Santorum and particularly Newt Gingrich,
yeah,
who starts talking about the food stamp
like that.
President. Mm-hmm. You know, folks, I mean, this has been repeated so many times. Please bear with me if you already know this, that the vast majority of people receiving food stamps today are white. In fact,
that is fact. And there is no arguing with facts.
And there's more white people receiving food stamps than black people and brown people combined.
That's right.
Yeah. But you know what? There is nothing wrong at all with actually receiving this. What is wrong is that Reaganomics, that with the final crowning glory being the Bush's tax cuts for the wealthy and these unnecessary wars that he led us into, created the context that destroyed our economy and necessitated so many people going on food stamps.
Yeah.
And by the way, both George Bush on the right and also, I guess you would say, liberals here in Michigan, they wanted to get as many people on food stamps that were eligible. In other words, if you have eligibility, you should accept that for sure. Here, this is Timothy Casey. He's a senior staff attorney with Legal Momentum. It's the nation's oldest legal defense and education fund dedicated to advancing the rights of all women and girls. He said, when it comes to programs to aid the poor, some of the leading candidates for the Republican presidential nomination are rushing to the bottom. All of them. Newt Gingrich and Rick Santorum have played the race card, implying that food stamps and other programs for those in need are programs for blacks. Hey, wait a minute.
That is just absolutely horrid.
Yeah, I mean, when we have a situation now, where I hopefully still have this from last week, where they said that 43% of us, of people in this country, are either in poverty or near either poor or near poor.
Yes.
Well, hello. I mean, the wealth is so impacted in that upper 1% and upper 10% that the people on the bottom are getting worse and worse and worse. And what do these mean son of a bitches want?
I know, they want to just starve.
Ron Paul just wants to, hey, take care of yourself. Let the churches do
it. Yeah,
you know?
and then the Newt types, get a job. Well, it's exhausting how many times we have to think and say, where are the jobs? There are no jobs.
You know, one of the things, if you do a little anagramming, if you put Gingrich's last name around, shift the letters,
yeah,
you got Grinch.
Well,
here's what he said.
I have a lot of other words for him, but that's a good one.
He is counting on the stupidity of white people that they will vote in terms of race rather than their own financial interests.
Man, have we not gotten anywhere in this country? Crying out loud.
Yeah. Here's what, there's an article in the New York Times, Preaching Division in South Carolina, the New York Times editorial, accusing correctly Newt Gingrich of trying to stampede people into a politics of resentment. Here's what he says, and here is the important part of it, is not what he says, but what came after. The fact is that more people have been put on food stamps by Barack Obama than any president in American history. He announced to wild cheers.
That is just...
These are some sick people.
Yeah, they really
that
are.
That adhere to this philosophy. They are the politics of division, the politics of rage, the politics of, yeah, well, of greed, too. I think of politics of fear. I don't even think it's so much greed. I mean, the greed is at the top. I mean, that's why they want to, you know, keep Republicans in.
Well, they don't... the politics of zero compassion.
Yeah, well, there you go, too. Barack Obama has put no one on food stamps whatsoever. It's not what he has. And that's not what's there. There's a supplemental nutrition assistance program called SNAP, and it's people are getting it because they're poor, out of work, and their families, here's the key word, folks, their families are hungry. The number of people using the program, which is correctly now at a peak, began when? 2007. Let's see. Who was in office?
Uh-huh.
Barack Obama? No. It was George Bush.
Bush, yeah.
The guy that public admits to war crimes in his memoir.
Uh-huh. And is fine with it and would do it all over again.
Did you know that the conservative mayor, he's a member of the Conservative Party, he's the mayor of London, and he warned George Bush not to come to Europe, that he could be arrested for war crimes because he admits to waterboarding in his memoir.
Yeah.
He confesses to an international war crime. Torture, yeah. So anyway,
He's hanging around Crawford. Yeah, you don't hear anything. The guy, not that he cares or has any conscience whatsoever about anything he did. He thinks everything is perfectly hunky-dory.
Here's what the Times says as well. Non-Hispanic whites, that's us, also far outnumber blacks receiving SNAP, food stamp benefits. As for the notion that these people are somehow, that are people who somehow like their dependency, 30% of SNAP households have income from work, a reminder of the brutal impact of the recession on wages, which are just being driven down further and further and further. So people working their butts off and cannot get enough money to sufficiently support their family. And then you've got these, you know, like Newt Grinch wanting to return to child labor.
Yeah.
I mean, well, what is with these people?
He didn't exactly put it that way.
No. Well, but yeah, he said that they ought to
say child labor, did he?
Well, no, he said that he's starting this fat old rich guy is that, you know, this lobbyist, this corrupt politician, this insider, this liar, this serial philanderer.
Yeah.
Lecturing poor African American people on work habits.
Oh, it's disgusting.
Where this guy goes to Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac and gets $1 million. He was just on
donations.
He got paid as an advisor.
Oh, that's right.
Yeah, and he says, I wasn't a lobbyist. I was an advisor.
Yeah. Okay.
Hey, I'll tell you what.
Keep trying, Newt.
These are mortgage companies, Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac. I'll tell you what. Next time, if anyone's listening from the management there, next time you need somebody, you know, you gave him $1 million. I'm not going to ask for $500,000. I'll do it for $20,000.
You will?
Think of this.
I'll do it for $100,000.
you'd be worth more.
Why?
Well,
because I'm a woman?
No, because you're asking for more. It must be, your advice must be worth more.
Oh, yeah, that's right.
On the face of
it. I must know more. And now they've gone after Newt pretty hard. I mean, he's really under fire because of the wife number two, Marianne Gingrich, coming out and talking about how he asked for open marriage. Were we going to go there now? Do you want
to
go there now?
He's into polyamory.
Which I think it is fine. Polyamory is fine, but the problem about
did you do that? Were you into polyamory during your marriage?
No, I never was. He wouldn't go for it. He was so boring. But I wish we might still be married. I wouldn't be bored anymore. Oh, yeah. But, you know, polyamory in the true sense is, or open marriages, same thing, you're just not married, right, really,
right.
Is when you have a truly loving relationships and with more than one person, but the communication is open and it's about honesty and it's about transparency and the partners know about each other and it can work. It's a difficult way to go, but it can work. But what Newt did was he had an affair with Calista for 6 years and then came and asked if they could have an open relationship. That usually doesn't bode well.
No, it doesn't go over very well. But, you know, it's interesting, too, because on one hand, you could let's say that through some incredible stretch of the imagination that Newt Gingrich was actually a sincere person. I mean, just for the sake of argument.
Let's try.
So the guy says, look, now I'm a granddad, you know, and I'm really not up for any more relationships.
I better settle down.
Yeah, one's enough.
You know? I've been a total a-hole all these years.
Right. What do they say?
Slime ball.
Yeah. Once a king, always a king. Once a knight, that's enough. Right? So maybe he just figured he's like in retirement from philandering.
So
that's not giving the benefit of the doubt. He's had this great conversion to Jesus. You know, he's this devout Catholic now. He's finally got his life. So should he always be judged by his past sins of corruption and philandering and feeding at the public trough and professional politics?
Should he? Yes, he should. I would throw that out to the audience as well. Should we give the guy a break ever? Because now he's found the Lord and he and Callista have been together for a long time. Hey, the new thing is, did you know Callista doesn't have any eyelids? Did you read that one?
Eyelids?
Not eyelashes. Her eyes are always...
Eyelashes?
Eyelids.
Eyelids. Must be.
Her eyes are always... If you look at her...
Must be tough waking up and, you know, like at night and looking over at her.
Oh, all she has to do is wear one of the little masks.
And... Oh. Where, somewhere in here.
And how about this, Peter? And he put this all on his daughters from the first marriage.
Oh, yeah.
So they came out to support daddy. And, you know, listen, I'm a daddy's girl. I would support him until the dying end. But if Newt Gingrich were my dad, I don't know. I might just say, I'm out of here.
Here in South Carolina, the South Carolina's attorney general detects voter fraud during the primaries. Already there's been some question into folks who cast their ballots on Saturday. South Carolina's Attorney General Alan Wilson has notified the U.S. Justice Department of potential voter fraud. Wilson says an analysis found 953 ballots cast by voters who were people listed as dead.
Oh, right. That happens.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So I don't know what to make of that.
Well, and you know, the other big news about that stupid Iowa caucus. That Santorum actually came out ahead of that. Remember when I told you my mom said, because Romney's her boy, and she said, Julian, I by doing this, I learned that every vote really counts.
Yeah.
And I didn't have the heart to call her and rub it in. Your boy Mitt, I think she just likes him because she thinks he's good looking. I think that's how my mom bases her votes.
I mean, it is. I mean, I suppose to your mother's credit that she's probably going for the most liberal guy that there is.
Yeah.
I mean, he's the only one with any single accomplishment. None of them have done anything except destructive things throughout their career.
Yeah.
They've all just been these corrupt politicians. He put in Romney Care. So he actually provided medical care for everybody in Massachusetts.
He did, and which was a beautiful thing. And, you know, he called it Romney Care in a speech recently. And
By mistake. And he is a fake conservative, although he's doing a good job of it. So the criticism of him that he is conservative in name only is probably true. What the other thing, now, who's been bashing gays? Is it just Santorum? Or let me see. Oh, well, the horrible Michelle Bachmann was as well. But
God, remember her?
Yeah, remember her. Hey, by the way, nobody wants to take us up on this, that the idea that liberals or Democrats or people like us.
Progressives
can vote in the Republican primary in Michigan. And it would make sense either to vote for Gingrich, who would be the easiest target.
We'd like to get him in there.
Yeah, the easiest target for Obama.
Not into office, but we'd like to get him to be the one that Obama goes against.
Or for Ron Paul, who about three-quarters of his program is either...
Now it's three-quarters? It was a half.
No, he's half mad. I mean, you know, absolutely insane. I mean, he's the guy that said, you know, we're all Austrians now.
Yeah, what was that all about?
It's about this crazy, you know, free market... ideology by these guys. I mean, it's Reaganomics. It's what's destroyed the American economy. Anyway, so when you get a guy like Santorum that bashes gays, I mean, he tries to do it in a compassionate way.
Oh, please.
It translates into this. This is a report that came out recently. Gay and transgender people in all regions around the world face discrimination and violence, including killings, rape, and torture because of their orientation, and risk the death penalty in at least five countries, according to the United Nations. In the first official report on the issue, the United Nations said that in addition to spontaneous street violence, people perceived as being members of a sexual minority may be targets of organized abuse, including by... Now, who would these people vote for in this country? Gays are targets of an organized abuse, including by religious extremists,
yep,
paramilitary groups, neo-Nazis, and extreme nationalists.
And these Republican nutballs.
Well, I think that includes all of
them. What you're saying, they're all kind of, now they're all in one happy little category.
76 countries have laws that criminalize behavior on the basis of sexual orientation or gender identity. So when the Rick Santorums or the Michelle Bachmans or anyone else tries to exclude gay people from the entirety of our society, they're setting the context for this. It's not like, you know, they're organizing neo-Nazi mobs or religious nutballs to go out and do something to folks like this, but it sets the larger social context in which this violence will occur. So when violence against our neighbors and our relatives and our friends and our loved ones who are gay get hurt by some crazy skinhead or something like that, mm-hmm, Rick Santorum is partially responsible for it. I mean,
he is.
Go there with that.
Right? And more. And by the way, while you're at it, Google his name, last name. Go ahead.
Adults only, please.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
Hey, you know, one of the things in talking about inclusion, we didn't talk about, Jalene and I went to church on Monday.
We did. We went to church. We sat in the very back row, which is probably where they wanted us.
Yeah.
No, there were no seats left. If you look at, I posted a picture. I don't know if I posted that one on our page. Barb Ingalls, our friend, posted a picture, and you can see us way back up there in the corner.
Really?
Yes. I don't know why I find it so funny.
Anyway, what we're talking about, this was at the Central United Methodist Church at Campus Martius, downtown Detroit, and it was one of the many annual Martin Luther King observance days on Monday, and it was a huge crowd, bigger than usual. There was a march, maybe 1,000 people.
It was wonderful. The church was packed.
Yeah. And they had women who were the young women of the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee for the early 60s, now just grandmas.
Grandmas. There were four of them. They were spunky.
They were
spunky women. They each gave, they have a book out, and I wish I had the title in front of me.
The Women of SNCC, SNCC.
Oh, that's right. Okay.
The Women of SNCC.
I would totally suggest, if you're a reader, getting that one. These women were so wonderful, and they talked about what they did back in that day. They were brave women, I look back and I wonder, God, could I have done that? You know?
And there was actually one of the things that is the most dramatic is Professor Gloria House, incredible academic and playwright and poet. I've read this account. She was in some town in Alabama, and there was a bunch of civil rights people, including two white ministers. Suddenly, this white guy comes out of this shop with a shotgun and shoots both of the white ministers, kills one of them, cripples the other.
Yeah.
He's tried for murder and found not guilty for reasons of self-defense. He thought they were going to attack him.
And they were just standing there.
Yeah.
Right, yeah. Boy,
and she was right there. I mean, the bullets were flying.
Yeah, she talked about that, and it was really moving, really moving. But a great march.
We actually went on one of the smaller ones, though. There was an estimated 2,500 people from across Metro Detroit who walked a mile in Southfield from the Hope United Methodist Church to the Southfield Pavilion. And, you know, I wonder that if this, maybe not, because, well, here's what I wonder, whether this is, that Martin Luther King Day has just become kind of like another patriotic holiday. You know what I mean? Where people make patriotic speeches, wave the flags. But, you know, it seems there's an intensity here on the part of all people, of all colors, to commit themselves to a country that isn't defined by these dividers, these stooges for the rich. It sounds like I'm dividing people. But
they divided themselves.
They divided themselves, yeah. And in Ann Arbor, about 1,000 civil rights supporters, union organizers, and Occupy Detroit, they have not gone away, went over to the Ann Arbor neighborhood of Governor Rick Snyder to rally against the state's emergency manager law, which is so clearly illegal and unconstitutional.
That was a pretty big one, too.
Yeah.
Yeah, they were all good. I like the one we went to because that was the site of the where Martin Luther, excuse me, Martin Luther King Jr. gave the I Have a Dream speech. He wrote it in that church.
He wrote it in that
church. There for the very first time before he went to the big rally.
Yeah. And then I think, someone can remind us of the history, I think then Martin Luther King, there was a big march in June in downtown Detroit, which King led. And I think he may have given the I Have a Dream speech then as well. But somebody may remind us. All right. We have Eric and Fred and Linda waiting. And I thought, you know, come on. Folks, I thought this was going to be a great topic about, well, first off.
There's people calling.
They are. But do you think, A, do you think it's appropriate for people who are not Republicans to vote in the Republican primary?
And yeah, are we being bad?
I mean, the Republicans are doing everything they can to suppress the vote. They're trying to get as few people voting. They're doing all this, altering of these voting districts to make sure they get
the redistricting.
The redistricting stuff and all that. So, I mean, why shouldn't we play with the system a little?
Yeah.
And if we do vote in the Republican primary, people like me and Jalene, for instance, should we vote for Newt Gingrich or for Ron Paul?
Yeah. Which one? What should we do?
And I had one other little teaser when I came. I can't remember, but I'll think of it when I come back.
Okay.
You're listening to Night Call with Peter Werby and Jalene Jordan on 101 WRIF. Let your opinion be heard. Call us at 313-298-WRIF.
Whatever's going on, it seems to be far from over.
Peter and Jalene will be taking more of your calls right after this.
Stop by Lowe's this week for great savings. Save more than $8 on a six-pack of Utilitech 65-watt indoor floodlights, now just $6. Plus, get a two-pack of Utilitech 90-watt outdoor floodlights for only $4.98. And if you want to save money and water, get a new AquaSource dual-flush toilet for just $98. That's a savings of $20. Find these and other great values on the products you need to improve your home inside and out. But you better hurry. Supplies won't last long. Lowe's. Never stop improving. Offers valid through 1/23/12.
Are you over the age of 25 and need to lose more than 30 pounds? If so, the next 30 seconds are crucial to your well-being because Sensa is sending 30-day free trials to anyone looking to lose the max amount of weight. To experience the most dramatic weight loss results, you must want to lose over 30 pounds. Call 1-800-964-5392 now. Due to overwhelming demand, there is a strict limit of one free trial per household. 1-800-964-5392. 1-800-964-5392.
Thanks for rocking with the Riff online. This is WRIF.com.
This is Night Call on 101 WRIF. Voice your opinion at 313-298-WRIF. That's 313-298-9743. Now, here are Peter Werby and Jolene Jordan.
All right, welcome back. Thank you very much. One of the things we're talking about is should people who aren't Republicans intervene in the Michigan primary and vote for someone in there? Just either like to screw them up or to make a point or something like that.
Oh, it's to screw them up and you know it.
You can email us at calltalkyes@yahoo.com. Go to our Facebook page, facebook.com/nightcall, and they're redoing them. I can't believe on your site, what a wonderful picture of you and Ann Carlini, our midday disc jockey.
Yeah, 25 years Ann Carlini's been on the air here.
Really?
I have a new magazine article. I write for Inside Macomb. It's Inside Macomb Magazine.
Right.
And so for February, I am doing an article with Ann. I interviewed her. She just recently became engaged to Joe. And anyone, he is with her a lot out at the Riff Gig, so a lot of people know who Joe is. Just a great guy. And, of course, my article is about a little bit about music and a little about cooking, because I'm in culinary school. And so she is going to cook for her. He cooks a lot. She's going to cook for her man for Valentine's Day, and so it's kind of all about that,
And if you want to go to your Facebook page, it's Juline, J-U-L-I-N-E, like Juline, Jordan, right?
Mm-hmm, yeah.
Like the basketball player.
You can see
the
picture, and if you're not crazy and have a Confederate flag as your profile pic, I'll add you.
Our podcast is available Monday. Oh, hey, techies, go to my webpage. Help me out. Peter Werby, W-E-R-B-E.com. It is all screwed up, and I cannot figure out how to undo it. Give it a look. Peter Werby, W-E-R-B-E.com. You can say, wait a minute, Pete, aren't you supposed to have people on your staff? That you're looking at the staff right here, All right, let's get some calls. Here's Linda in Pontiac. Linda, thanks for joining us. You're on the air. Go ahead.
Hi, Peter and Julene. I listen to you guys all the time. I love your show.
Well, thank you,
Linda.
And first, I have a question, but I wanted to say, first of all, I consider myself a Democrat, and I would not vote for Newt Gingrich or Mitt Romney.
Well, this is just for the primary.
This is the primary,
not for the actual vote. This is to, like, it's a tactic.
In other words, you might want to get, like, the worst person, you know, help the worst person
get in to go against Barack Obama.
Like the easiest person that has a chance. The only two people that have a chance of getting the nomination, right, are Willard or Newt, right? So
right.
Newt would probably be the easiest because he's the, you know, the wackiest one and has the worst baggage and probably is not even electable. So one of the strategies of Democrats is to get him to be the nominee. So I guess what I'm saying is, I mean, you don't want to vote in the Democratic primary because no one's running against Obama in the primary. So you know what I'm talking about?
Yeah, I don't know.
You don't want to sully.
Can't do it.
I know
dirty.
What you mean. I would feel dirty. I don't know if I'm going to do it or not.
I'll just take a shower and I'll just move on.
Yeah, I don't know if I would spend my time to vote in the Republican primary just to screw them up. But I wanted to know if you know or any of your callers know, who decided that Iowa and New Hampshire always get to vote first?
Well, the state legislatures.
And Iowa, Iowa was a caucus.
Yeah.
So it was a different thing. It wasn't a primary.
The ones that are the first, it used to be New Hampshire all the time, but
but who did decide that?
Well, it's the states, and they were, and there's a whole big, you know what? It's one of those things I care so little about, Linda, that I don't even pay that much attention to them. And I really resent that the news media has shoved this all into our face because it's kind of a combination of a soap opera and a sporting event, right? A blood sport. So it's getting rating. Yeah, go ahead.
Why do they place so much importance on these two states? Like, people will drop out afterwards.
Well, I guess they see, you know, which way the wind's blowing, because it's pretty clear that people, I'm forgetting most of them now, thankfully, but like Huntsman and Bachman and Herman King.
Perry dropped out.
Oh, yeah, Perry. Yeah, right. Which is good.
It's about time. What a waste of breath and money.
It is indeed. But, you know, here's what I'm wondering, Linda. why in the world a state, for instance, like people like myself and Jalene, who consider ourselves independent, I do not consider myself a Democrat. I'm not a member of the Democratic Party.
And why, I will speak for myself and say he's right.
Why do I and Jalene and anyone else, why do we have to pay for a private political party's nomination process? In other words, if you get more than a certain percentage of the vote in Michigan, by statute, your party is required to have an open primary to select the candidate. This was done as an anti-corruption trend because they didn't want the candidates selected in smoky back rooms. You know, guys used to, you know, all guys, and they'd be all smoking cigars, and they'd say, okay,
yeah.
Willard's going to be our candidate. But, you know, I be that what it may, I don't want to have to pay for the Republican primary. And you and I are paying for the Republican primary, even if we can vote in it or not. But
that's on the taxpayers?
Sure. I mean, the election costs a lot of money. I mean, for the state. I don't mean all these insane ads and what have you, but just the mechanism of the electoral process. They have to collect all the ballots. They have to get, the electoral, workers. I mean, I don't know what it costs, but I'm sure it costs at a minimum several hundred thousand dollars in a state afford it. And I figure, I don't know, why don't they just have duels or flip coins or...
I like the idea of duels.
Yeah. That would solve the problem pretty quick.
I mean, it's entertaining as hell right now, but that would be really entertaining.
Thank you, Linda.
Yep, thanks.
Thanks, Linda. Thanks for listening.
You think it's entertaining? I think it is so terminally boring.
Well, I don't watch any of the debates. I mean, are you kidding me, Peter?
All right.
I wouldn't put myself through that.
Here's Andrea in Brighton. Andrea, thanks for calling 313-298-WRIF. You're on the air. Welcome.
Well, I just have to say I'm very excited about all the Republican candidates. They're all totally crazy in their own special way.
That's for sure.
To me. Because none of them have a chance of winning, I don't think.
Well,
I agree. I mean,
it is scary.
I'd be surprised.
Go ahead.
To answer your question, I would probably vote for Ron Paul because I think that he just has like a small select group of people who would vote for him, I think.
It's mostly young guys that have like liter bottles of Pepsi with them at all times.
What? Oh. Where'd you get that?
I'm telling you. Can I get a witness?
A big gulp.
Yeah. And they're very enthusiastic about him, and it's like, on the right, and I don't think a lot of them even really consider Ron Paul a right-winger, but he is so far right-wing that he has literally dropped off the political spectrum. But it's like people on the left, when you start criticizing Obama from the left, and people just get a little, like liberals, they get a little embarrassed because you're saying, yeah, he did this, and he didn't do that, and he didn't. And the same way, when you start bringing up that Ron Paul wants to abolish Medicaid and Medicare and Social Security, that he wants to get rid of the minimum wage, that he wants to go back on the gold standard, that he wants the country to be ruled by Austrian economics, they just go, they've kind of put their fingers in their ears and go la 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 like that, and contrary, hey man, he's against the drug war, he's against having a military empire all across the world, and I mean that's good. But who I wish was running would be Dennis Kucinich. And I wonder why these guys wouldn't get all excited about him. Because Dennis Kucinich, the representative from Cleveland, has all of the Ron Paul points about foreign policy and civil liberties. But he understands that people can't be left to the vagaries of the market, or that we're going to wind up like we did 200 years ago or 100 years ago, that we have to have strict regulations on capitalist enterprises or
laws.
Yeah, labor law. These nutballs like Ron Paul don't even want labor laws or safety laws and all that. It's got to be, people don't like working there because they have unsafe machines. Let them go somewhere else. Oh, well, you can't because they don't have hands anymore. They have two stumps.
Right.
All right. Thank you very much. Appreciate it. Actually, I'm trying to draw out some Ron Paul people. Come on. Give me a defense of that whack job. Here is Eric and Wayne. Eric, hi, you're on the air. Whoa. You could just hear the crickets on that.
He hung up.
Yeah. He waited 45 minutes.
Oh, come on.
You know, maybe it was in one of those things. He waited 45 minutes and like 29 seconds. And One more second.
Yeah. Well, call back.
Yeah.
We have a couple of open lines.
Some open lines for you. 313-298-WRIF. Here's Brenda in Waterford. Hi, Brenda. You're on the air.
Yeah, hi, Peter. Hi, Jillian. Hi. I love your show on Sunday nights.
Well, thank you.
I look forward to Sunday nights. But, hey, I just wanted to talk to you. I'm not talking to you about the Democrat-Republican primaries that are going on right now. But
it's okay.
I went to this church service. I don't know if you've ever heard of Kensington Church in Troy.
Oh, yes. I can talk all day about this.
She's got her hand up, too.
Hey, testify! No, I don't go there, but I know people. I know a musician who plays there, and I know all about it.
Oh, they're fantastic musicians there. But what prompted me to call you, Jillian, was when you just mentioned, oh, yeah, you know, I thought we would burn in church if we were seen in church.
Yeah.
But what prompted me to think that this past Sunday, they had a couple of guys, one from Israel and the other from Palestine, I think.
Mm-hmm.
But my point of the whole story is that they said that they had had 15 Jews and 15 Israelis that they had and drag out to the desert, 30 guys with only 15 camels. And by the end of the 3 or 4 day excursion, everybody was all friends. But I mean, I just wanted to call and tell you.
Wait.
Okay. I can tell you what happened.
Wait, let me, but I think you meant 15 Palestinians and 15 Israelis?
Yes, that's what I said.
But go ahead. All right.
Yeah.
And they only had 15 camels. Is that what they ate?
They dragged them out to the desert. The point was that everybody can get along.
Oh.
Well, it can happen, but, you know, not when it involves the Israeli army and Palestinian civilians. What Kensington did was they went over on a mission, and then they brought back a bunch of video. And do you go every week there?
No, I'm brand new to the church. It's my second or third time I've ever gone, and I was just floored by how wonderful this place was.
I guess that it's wonderful, but I just have two words to say, or one hyphenated word.
Hyphen away.
Kool-Aid.
Hey, you know what, though? It's pretty interesting, Brenda. We, Jillian and I are not religious at all, but we went to this church for the Martin Luther King observance.
Yeah, she mentioned that about us burning the worried that it was going to explode.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
And when you see these people and the way they express their religiosity, you get pretty soft towards it because
it's
all about peace. It's all about love. It's all about compassion. It's all about sharing. It's all about love. And that's the way they express it. And what I've said, if I had to empirically, that is to say, what I've seen in my lifetime of religion directly, not what I hear reported on the news, which is always awful, but the religious people that I know and the religious people that I know that act in the world, you'd say, these are wonderful institutions. Well, I mean, the Central United Methodist Church has been for probably 150 years the center of progressive and liberal
social justice,
civil rights, civil liberties.
Yeah, they had a big banner that I don't know if you saw because it was below where we were sitting, and it said Michigan says no to war. A big, huge banner. I'll send you that picture. Yeah. But no, I think that that Kensington does a lot of really good things. I'm just extremely leery of these mega churches. I just can't deal with it.
Well,
you know, and I am too, Jillian, really, and Pierre, I really am too. But I guess what my point is that there can be peace, you know, one person at a time, you know, I mean, they've not converted me, I guess what you'd say, if I am praising peace, that means I can tell somebody else, you know, that the Arabs aren't all bad, you know, I mean, that's the point of the whole thing, you know, I mean, people want world peace, you know, it's not just the media that are telling us that, you know, people don't want peace, but the people do want peace, do you know what I mean?
Yeah, well, the people do.
When
you say people, that's the 99% of us. 99% of the people in the world want peace. But then either the politicians create the context for war, or sometimes what they do is they whip people up to into these frenzies, to these frenzies of rage, where then they attack their neighbors because, gee, you know, and it's not even, you know, like Judaism and Islam. I mean, it can be Protestant and Catholic. I mean, think about these wars in Europe or what still goes on in Northern Ireland because, or between the Sunni and the Shia. I mean, because, oh gee, you know, for all the goodness that I see coming out of the religious communities that I'm aware of, overall, I mean, they've got a sorry record, a real sorry record, indeed. No, well, listen, let's not end it on a negative, the call on negative.
Hey, thanks for taking my call. I appreciate it. Well, just want to get it out there. And
well, I'm glad you did, Brenda.
Enjoy the music. I know that they have top-notch musicians playing there.
Yeah, so they often do.
They'll play Led Zeppelin, Peter. They, you know.
Yeah.
So, I mean, at least it's, okay.
All right, thank you, Brenda.
I'm done. I just
you have a great night.
Would never go. And a dear friend of mine plays in the band and tried to get me to go, and I just said yes. Yeah, so.
You know, let me see. Do we have time before how many? I can never figure this. From let me just move.
Are you doing math, Peter?
Yeah, well, I was going to start something here. It's 11:53. Well, I'll bring this up. I mean, could you imagine anything more boring? we got a caller from hell.
Oh, well, what's that? Oh, yeah. From hell, Michigan?
Yeah.
Okay.
All right. As always. I used to do a lot of bicycle riding, and there's a city in Michigan called Bliss. And I wanted to do a ride from hell to bliss.
I like it.
Yeah.
But, or maybe bliss to hell would be more fun.
Well, remember I always quote Mark Twain, heaven for the climate, hell for the company. But can you imagine, this will be the challenge when we come back, to talk about the average rate for the average water and sewage rates growing up. I mean...
Well,
could we make that interesting?
Well, I'll tell you how we can make it interesting, because people are already struggling to pay their water and sewage bills.
That's right. All right. Hang on. And some open lines, 313-298-WRIF. Oh, wait a minute. Don't we hire some guy to do that?
And we have a couple of people waiting on hold, so we'll get to you when we come back. Yeah. And we do have someone that we pay to do that.
Yeah.
You're listening to Night Call with Peter Werby and Jolene Jordan on 101 WRIF. Peter and Jolene are taking your calls at 313-298-WRIF.
That's what we do.
We'll be taking more of your calls right after this.
Trojan Man. Attention, pleasure seekers. Trojan Bearskin Condoms are bringing couples closer than ever before. At an amazing 40% thinner than our standard condoms, just listen to what this couple has to say.
The irresistible
closeness and
amazing
sensitivity
allow us
to feel
more
connected
than ever before.
It's like we become one.
Wow. Can't get much closer than that.
Get irresistibly closer with Trojan Bearskin Condoms. Triple tested quality from Trojan, America's number one most trusted condom brand.
Can't wait to get it on.
So we're back, and we got some more music coming up in just a second. But first, this news just came in. Right now, the government and private banks are liquidating houses. Now, these are homes that have been foreclosed, confiscated, or repossessed, and they may be sold for little or no money down. Here's a toll-free number so you can find out how to get a free list of these foreclosures. 1-800-923-1051. 1-800-923-1051. It says here, every house must be sold. The government and banks are very motivated to sell these homes, and they may be sold for little or no money down. Looks like there's currently over 400,000 foreclosures in the database being liquidated now. Homes may be sold for little or no money down. Ask how you can get a free list of these foreclosures by calling Hot Props at 1-800-923-1051. Call 1-800-923-1051. That's 1-800-923-1051.
Detroit's rock station rocks worldwide. You're listening to WRIF.com.
I'm
good buddy Wiser. That's all I ever need, cause I drink alone. Yeah, with nobody else. Yeah, you know what, I drink alone. I prefer to be by myself. Yeah, the other night I lay sleeping, and I woke from a terrible dream. So I called up my pal Jack Daniel and his partner Jimmy Bean.
WRIF and WRIF HD1 Detroit. We're back with more Night Call on 101 WRIF. Voice your opinion at 313-298-WRIF. That's 313-298-9743. Here are Peter and Julie.
Thank you very much, and welcome to our second hour. We have some open lines for you. We're talking about everything under the sun, whether Democrats and liberals should vote in the Republican primary. And should they vote, like, for Ron Paul or Gingrich? To vote Gingrich, and because that's what the Democrats prefer. They think he'd be the easiest target for Barack Obama. I don't know, though. Maybe, you know, Romney is such a Mr. 1%, right?
Yeah, he is.
In character with that.
Well, but, you know, it's not like Newt Gingrich doesn't have a whole boatload of money.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, that's right. I mean, he's gotten millions and millions and millions off of... all this lobbying and all this big firm.
Many sources.
Many sources. I'm wondering here. I was looking for, oh, yeah, the news. And I guess Romney is going to release his taxes. He was always a little fudgy on that. I mean, he's got all this money. You know, he gave millions to the Mormon Church.
Mm-hmm.
He has got all this money on the Cayman Islands. It's all sequestered away.
He does, yeah. And his explanations are just a hoot.
Yeah. In the meantime, the average person in a country increasingly where almost 50% of us are either poor or near poor now, The Detroit Water and Sewage Department is going to raise rates this year, an average of almost 9%. He's, 9%, what the hell is that going to mean?
That's
well,
a lot.
You know what? If you live inside the city of Detroit, if you're one of those people that live in the suburbs and you don't have that mythical characteristic of a suburban dweller, that is that you're well off,
yeah,
and in fact you have suffered hard times, this is going to mean a lot to you. Now, here is what, so this is going to create this increase. Get this in this story in the Detroit Free Press. One reason for recent water rate increases has been a decline in sales due to a poor economy and rising foreclosures. I mean, this is the most insane sentence that I have seen.
Say it again.
Okay. One reason for recent water rate increases has been a decline in sales. Okay. So people, I guess, are using less water because of the poor economy and rising foreclosures. So people are actually being forced out of their houses. So these people in the Detroit Water and Sewage Department are going to raise water rates.
Oh, man.
So that'll make it harder for people to pay off their mortgage or to have enough money to spend on what they have to spend it on.
Yeah, fewer showers, I see, in the future.
And one of the reasons also is that there's a decline in sales is that tens of thousands of people have had their water shut off in the city of Detroit.
Oh, my gosh.
You know, I mean, think about this. Aren't there some things that are that we deserve as a matter of right that you need to live on, that you need to live in the world on, like water? You don't have the money for it? Sorry. You know, actually, there was a play.
Yeah, your SOL.
Yeah, yeah. I saw.
Oh, Urinetown?
Urinetown. Yeah.
I can speak for you before you even. Urinetown was an off-Broadway play.
Yeah.
And you tell about it. Well, you're the one who saw it.
Well, I mean, this was how this corporation controlled all the water.
Well,
and all the
also,
and all the urine,
the bathrooms.
Yeah, all the bathrooms.
Yeah, you had to pay.
Which
in New York City, and there are cities. I think Chicago even. You have to pay. There's public restrooms that you put your little quarter in, so you can go.
Now, even in the area of utilities, there's people that have genuine concern and compassion, and they have this. I forgot what it stands for. Thaw.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
What's that stand for?
I don't know what it's called for.
But it's heat, the H is assistance. For heating, I think, or yeah. A is for assistance, and W is for warmth or something.
You can donate money.
Yeah, and the news station in Detroit, WWJ, has this big thaw phone-a-thon and all. I don't know. I can mention another station because nobody, people aren't going to start listening to that boring-ass station. Oh, God. But I shouldn't. Well, there's a good reason why I shouldn't say that, but nothing to do with this station. Anyway. You imagine this, that here are these, the Detroit Water and Sewage Department properly is a city utility. Something, the concern, all of a sudden I can't think of who owns, not Detroit Edison, what do they call it now? Or is it Detroit Edison?
DTE.
DTE. They control the gas, right, and all that for people in Detroit. And so if you don't have enough money, you can't pay their bills, and it's owned by stockholders, so you got the 1% that's owning DTE.
Oh, yeah.
And if poor people can't find the wherewithal in this economy caused by the 1%, the poor economy caused by the 1%, they cut their heat off.
That is just shameful.
So then it falls upon us in the 99% to have to pay more out of our money to heat the homes of our neighbors. Because of the compassion we have. So the 99% have the compassion, the 1% have zero, and they're the ones that rule us.
Yeah.
What's wrong with this equation, folks?
Everything.
There you go. There you go. Open lines at 313-298-WRIF. Let's see. Here is Fred. Fred's in Detroit. Fred, thanks for being so patient. Hi, you're on the air.
Hi, Jolene and Peter.
Hi.
Hi, Fred.
Okay, I got a couple of things, but to get that opening question out of the way about the Republican primary,
sure.
I would like to have thrown John Huntsman a sympathy vote, because I don't think he ever stood a chance against against the nasties.
John Huntsman, he was Obama's ambassador to China, so I don't think he was going to do well with the Republicans anyway.
Well, overall, he seemed less angry, less flipped, and more rational than the rest
of them. Yeah, and he did.
He didn't do well.
He has gotten some attention, though, just because of what you're saying
He wasn't a whack job.
Yeah.
He didn't.
I guess
do
you
well.
Have to be a total whack job to really get in the Republican Party.
Well,
wait,
yeah.
Of course you do.
Wow.
Now, I heard you say something about some voting irregularities in South Carolina, too.
About 1,000 dead people voted in South Carolina. Sounds like Chicago 50 years ago.
Well, between that and what happened in Iowa, I can actually imagine the Republicans doing that to try and justify all these voting restrictions and laws they're trying to put in place around the country.
I was thinking about
doing
that. Well, usually what they claim is, of course, that it's the poorer people, and you know what that is a code word for, right?
Right.
That are the people committing the voter fraud. And here suddenly it's the Republicans. So maybe we ought to have special restrictions on voting for the Republicans, because no one's ever accused, at least not in 50 years, since Mayor Daley in Chicago. I know Democrats don't like to hear this. Literally stole the 1960 election for John Kennedy. The Democrats aren't doing any voter fraud. It's all Republicans.
Well. I do see that. I know it can happen anywhere at any time, but we know the odds are going to always favor the Republicans to do some kind of chicanery.
Well, they do, and one of the things that has to happen, Fred, is that the Democrats always have to win really big, because if it's a
right.
narrow election, then they're going to pull out some trick, like they stole the election in 2000 and 2004 for Bush by chicanery, as you said. Great word, great old-fashioned word, but still a good one. In Florida in 2000 and in Ohio in 2004, without a doubt.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, the last thing was about this pipeline.
Oh, the pipeline that Obama said no to. Well, that was very cool.
Which one was this?
This was the Keystone.
The XL.
The XL one that everybody was demonstrating against. And
Oh, yeah.
The one that's supposed to go from Canada down
right.
to these refineries, I think, in Louisiana or Texas. Right.
Well, they're hanging this around his neck. And from what I recall, it was actually Nebraska that didn't want this.
That was
like
a good
thing. Last week, they talk about states' rights all the time, and there's this big disconnect in remembering that, well, state government is still government.
Right. Well, the governor of Nebraska, who is a Republican, didn't want it going through his state. And what it does, it takes Canadian oil, it ships it down to American refineries who then export it. So it's not going to do anything for gas prices here or get us any more gasoline. You know, I'll tell you, who wanted it, of course, were the unions up there who are desperate for work. And that's one of the things Republicans were hoping to do. I mean, they couldn't care less about gas. I mean, the higher the gas prices, the more their sponsors, the rich people like the Koch brothers become. But they could use this as a wedge against the Democrats, hoping they could split off some labor groups.
That's what roads, bridges, and drainage systems are for.
Yep.
They needed more TARP money.
There you go. All right, Fred, thank you very much. I appreciate
Thanks,
your
Fred.
Call. 313-298-WRIF. You ready to go to hell?
I'm always ready to go to hell.
Here's Clyde in Hell, Michigan. Clyde, hi, you're on the air.
You find yours too. Hey, now it's Eric from Southgate. Pete, I've been listening to you. Am I still on?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I've been listening to you since I was 11. You lost your whack, man. John Sinclair and Adam Brooke are pissed at you. And hope to see y'all at the, what is it?
Hash Bash?
John Sinclair is not pissed at Peter Werby.
No. I raised that boy up.
Adam, and we supported Adam on the air.
Pete, there's a roaring Borealis. Could you go see it, Julian?
Tonight?
Yeah, right now outside.
Ooh, well,
Borealis. This is Eric from Southgate. I'm 41. Going to be 41. And Julian?
Julian.
Well, I remember I said it was like Julian.
Oh, okay, Julian.
I found my Ouija board that you signed to Eric, Julian, Jordan, Riff Rocks.
I signed a Ouija board?
and Solly wouldn't even touch it.
Hey,
I signed a Ouija board?
Have a great one, Clyde, or wherever you are.
Okay, yeah.
Wow.
Okay. Whew.
Guy was smoking too much.
Nah, that's not weed, man. That's a whole nother thing.
It's just brain chemicals?
I don't know what it is, but it ain't weed.
Yeah. Little cigarettes in the voice, too.
You know, John Sinclair is our buddy.
He is our buddy.
He's our pal, and if anyone doesn't know who John Sinclair is...
Google him. Along with Santorum.
Yeah, but separately. Don't say John Sinclair Santorum in the same Google.
313-298-WRF. Here's Ken in Shelby Township. Hi, Ken. You're on the air. Welcome. Uh-oh.
Ken, turn your...
Here's a problem.
Turn your radio down.
Here's a problem.
Turn your radio down all the way.
Keep listening to this, Ken, because we're going to...
We're going
to
come back to you once you hear this.
We're going to come back to you, once you...
About 30 seconds.
All right. Let's see again. Hey, Ken, you're on the air.
Ken?
Hey, how you guys doing?
Good!
How you doing, Ken?
Very good. I was just driving home and didn't want to start a debate at all, but I couldn't help but feel you guys sound incredibly biased towards the Democratic Party.
No.
What?
No. I mean, you got it wrong.
Where this deep-seated hatred for the Republican Party comes from.
Well, we're biased against the Republican Party. We're not biased for
biased?
The Democrats.
Is that the word?
Well, it's okay. We have this...
I picked up that much from the conversation. I'm wondering where this deep-seated hatred for the Republican Party comes from.
Well, I don't know, reality, the fact that they've destroyed this country, the fact that they represent the 1%.
And they're like a lot of hatred towards certain people just because of their sexual orientation.
Or the color of their skin and their stuff like that.
You say that it would... Is that a common perspective of your audience?
I don't know. No, they have to call 313-298-WRIF. We speak only for ourselves and only.
That's good. I definitely respect you guys in your opinions. I'm just kind of curious from your perspective where this animosity is coming from.
What do you mean?
It's not even animosity.
It is animosity towards people that have policies that are essentially so lacking in compassion, that have done so tremendous much harm to this country, starting wars, giving favoritism to the ultra-rich.
The corporations.
So literally being in the pay of the corporations to get the 1% more money at the expense of you and me, Ken.
I would definitely agree with you that there is lots and lots of messed up things going on both sides of the spectrum. And that any kind of favoritism at this point, given how messed up both ends are, is just kind of silly at this point.
What do you think we should do?
Oh, gosh, I wish I had the right answer.
Well, I don't either.
I have a question. Where do you lie on the political?
I obviously lean more towards the Republican side, but I am not blinded. I definitely feel that there's just so many problems going on that there doesn't seem to be a clear view that, I hate the expression of the lesser of the two evils and running with that. I'm actually rooting for Ron Paul this year, but I don't think he really has a chance of winning it.
No, he doesn't. Well, we're going to vote in the Republican Party, or primary, rather, and maybe vote for Ron Paul.
I think he's the only candidate.
Well, we're doing it for other reasons.
For the past 30 years, he shared a consistent message of what he believes in, compared to either side of the party. And
on the other hand, I hope if you're voting for Ron Paul that you're not you wouldn't expect Social Security or any kind of socialist stuff.
Well, I haven't expected Social Security ever.
But you know what?
Why not?
But you're going to get it. There's nothing wrong with the system right now.
Yeah, well, I'm going to get Social Security. Yeah. You'll get Social Security. But
you might get Social Security, but its purchasing power will be so horrible by the time you actually receive it that it won't matter.
You mean there'll be such inflation?
Inflation, the loss of the dollar's value in the world of currency.
That's possible. That's all possible.
I'm curious about this. What makes you, I know this, I don't ask people this very often, but what makes you lean a little more right?
To be honest, I am an entrepreneur. I work hard for myself. I have created some growing, I guess, level of success for myself, and I start off at about a 50% tax rate and have to work my way down from there.
Wow, you need You're not in the 1% then, I take it.
No.
Yeah, well, yeah, because the small business guy does tend to get screwed. There's no doubt about that.
Yes, and a lot of I do get screwed. I appreciate saying that. And I believe in a lot of the same things that you guys are talking about helping your fellow neighbor. And what the problem is that the one, it's not the 1%, it's the very tippy top of the 1% that gives everybody else a bad name.
Well, yeah, I mean, ultimately, when you're talking about somebody that's making, you get into the 1%, I think, if you make $375,000. I mean, that's what, you know, Mitt Romney, they said, do you get any income from making speeches? And he said, yeah, about $350,000. He said, just a little bit, just about $350,000.
He downplayed. He thought that was no money because he's got so much money, and it's half of it's hidden in the Cayman Islands. Now, so you would say that you are a fiscal conservative.
I'm a constitutionalist.
Well, do you have a tattoo that says "Don't tread on me"?
Not yet. I'm thinking about it.
All right, Jim. Stay with. I'm glad you found us. Stay with us.
Jim.
Call us again. I appreciate it. Thanks for your call. All right. Here's something I want to talk about. James from Ann Arbor. Hi, you're on the air. Internet censorship. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Yeah, out of curiosity, what's your guys' opinion on, the censorship of the Internet that the government is trying to enforce?
You mean like SOPA?
SOPA and PIPA.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah,
well,
exactly.
You'll be pleased to know that it has been withdrawn as a bill, that there was so much fuss about it.
There's one thing that Obama said he was against it.
Yeah.
I heard about that.
And also, everybody withdrew, even so there were Republican and Democratic sponsors of this, what is it? Now all of a sudden I'm forgetting what they mean. The PIPA is Protect IP Act, and SOPA is Stop Online Piracy Act. And even the sponsors withdrew from it. So, and that was because some of the biggies and also smaller people had this online protest, got hundreds of thousands of people to write their congresspeople and all that.
I also heard that people were doing this, like ever since they issued the bill, that people would stop using it for an entire day. And because I had to go to work that day, I was obviously not using the Internet, so.
Well, that's what happened on last Wednesday. Google and I forgot who else. A couple of the biggies. Wikipedia completely was down.
Yeah, I saw that. That took me, like, out of left field. Like, when I was looking up something on Wikipedia, it showed this thing blocking me from looking at Wikipedia. I'm like, wow, that's.
Surprising. Okay. Wasn't it surprising?
It definitely took me off guard.
Yeah.
James, do you know what Mega Upload is? Well, Mega Upload is like a storage locker online. And the founder, it's a file sharing website. They've been arrested in New Zealand, but at the insistence of the American authorities. And because this happened, there's a group called Anonymous. You ever hear of them?
I definitely heard some things about them, yeah.
Yeah, they took down everyone's site connected, including the FBI. I tried to get on the FBI site after I read that.
Are you looking up yourself again?
Yeah, they're my wanted post. But they, so, yeah, these, you can understand why governments want to control the Internet, because it's out of their control, and they don't like things that are out of their control. They like to control everything, right?
Government conspiracy, man.
There you go. Thank you, James. Appreciate your call. You have a great night.
Hey, Alex wrote in and said you meant Consumers Energy, not DTE. I Consumers is who I have my heat through, but it's gas heat. Some people have electric heat, so that would
DTE has electric, and is it the people inside the city of Detroit don't get Consumers Power?
No, they don't.
Gas? Do they? No.
I don't know. I think it
Somebody
depends on if you have gas or electric, I thought.
Well, electric definitely is DTE.
Yeah.
And Consumer Power, do they send gas into the city
Consumers
of Detroit?
Energy, yeah.
Is it now Consumers Energy?
Yeah.
It used to be Consumer Power.
Yeah.
Consumers Power, whatever.
I know.
313-298-WRIF. Here's Edward somewhere. Where are you calling from, Edward? You're on the air.
Hey, boss. I'm calling just outside of Detroit. I'm a little curious. You guys mentioned Ron Paul, and I heard that guy saying stuff about the currency. Right now, our currency is, as you probably know, the world's reserve currency. Well, currently, the way our currency is being just manhandled in the whole private Federal Reserve system, I want to know, even if the American people realize that our dollar is forcibly being pushed down in value. It's not inflation. It's our dollar going down.
There's deflation could conceivably happen as well. Well, I don't know. You know, every modern capitalist country has a central bank, and the idea to get rid of it is absolutely nuts. I mean, it used to be...
The Federal Reserve.
Yeah, people used to, you know, have these militant demands, U.S. out of so-and-so, or stop the, you know, or something. Now people are saying, audit the Fed. Wow, how militant. Well, you know what? As far as I'm concerned, they can audit the Fed. I couldn't care less. But you got to have some central bank, handling monetary policy, or everything will go down the drain. I mean, the last thing in the world you want is a free market, because that will go right. Everything will go right down the tubes immediately.
Oh, I totally agree. But you look at Canada; their money is printed by their government. They own all the so-called printing machines, and they control the rates. In our country, the Fed is, we don't run the Fed. We don't control the money. We go, hey, Federal Reserve, we need $10 billion. And they give us $10 billion in digital money or physical money. I mean, our physical money is only, 3%? And they loan it to us at interest. How are we supposed to pay back that interest?
Well, it is just all smoke and mirrors. And for instance, I mean, these people talk about going back on the gold standard. There's not enough gold in the world to back the amount of currency or the amount of wealth that exists. And in fact, and I always say this, if they said to all, the 400 richest people in the world, bring your trillions, because there's enough money in the world so there doesn't have to be any poverty. It's just stuck in so few hands. But if you said, bring all the money tomorrow, and you got to bring it and put it on the table, they would all start to go, can we make that maybe next Wednesday or the Wednesday after?
I have some things I got to wrap up.
Senor Slim in Mexico, the richest guy in the world, or Bill Gates, the second richest guy. The two of them together almost have a personal wealth of $100 billion. And if you said, show up with it tomorrow in cash, they couldn't do it, right?
No, not at all.
So what does that mean?
You bring up Mexico. It's the largest bank in Mexico. I couldn't tell you the name of the bank, but when you go there to switch your money over to pesos, they won't take American dollars. Before, you could travel to Europe. I've been to Europe. I've never got my money transferred. I was over in Luxembourg. They wouldn't take U.S. dollars.
Really? I traveled to Amsterdam and Paris, and they did.
I never had any problem.
But when's the last time? Because I just went last year, and I didn't get my money changed or anything. Went to hand him and go, sorry, man, we don't take U.S. dollars anymore.
Listen.
It's scary when we can't even use our own dollars.
I don't know where it's all going. Yeah, I mean, the idea that that the dollar would cease to be, for instance, be the standard, the world standard, is frightening. Like, for instance, they were talking about switching from the dollar to the euro. I don't know if they still got that in mind for petrodollars, but so there'd be petro euros. But I don't know. I mean, we have a fake economy. We have fake wealth, although it seems to be, believed in to the extent that with all this false wealth that people can operate as it's real. So, I mean, people always use the example of the emperor has no clothes. And finally, the kid says, hey, the emperor is naked. And, I mean, that's always the possibility that everything could just crash, because the economy that you and I know is go to work and get paid. Or we had a caller before that has a small business, and he sells things or services and pays employees. And, it all kind of revolves around a pretty small little circle. But when you start dealing with exotic instruments, when you start having all this cyber wealth, well, I agree that there is the possibility, I'm not saying it's going to happen like some people do, of collapse, because someone's going to say, hey, none of this is real. Because it's, wealth to some extent is a bubble in the manner that that there was a housing bubble, or the first bubble was the tulip bulb bubble in Holland like 300 years ago, where people started paying the equivalent of thousands of dollars for like a single tulip bulb. Look at art. Look at art. I mean, people say, well, we don't know where the dollar is going, and we don't even know where gold's going, because that's probably a bubble as well. I mean, how much it's inflated. But we'll take paint on canvas and pay $125 million for it. Well, what gives it its value? What kind of intrinsic value does it have? We know the value of food. We know the value of clothing. We know the value of shelter. That makes sense. That's fundamental and key to human existence and comfort and what have you. But when you start getting into all of this stuff, when you start getting into the kind of what they keep referring to as exotic instruments of finance that very, very few people understand, it is definitely a prescription for trouble. All right, thanks for bringing that up, Edward. I definitely appreciate that. Some open lines for you, 313-298-WRIF.
Peter, you know what? We really have not given out the email address tonight. I don't think we've given it out once, but if you want to email us, calltalkyes@yahoo.com. And the Facebook page, before we go to a break, I want to get that in, facebook.com/nightcall. Join us.
Yeah, and I was appealing. People probably said, hey, you know, why don't you hire somebody? For my website, Peter Werbe, W-E-R-B-E.com, if you look at it, it's really screwed up. If you look at it in Mozilla, it's jumbled. Oh. And if you look at it in Explorer, it's still, there's something.
I was there today, and I thought it was.
It was okay. Yeah. I messed with it.
Okay.
I shouldn't have touched it.
Yeah. All right.
Going to be back with some very, very disturbing news about our soldiers. And some of you guys and gals that were over there may want to comment on this. But either way you cut it, it ain't pretty.
You're listening to Night Call with Peter Werbe and Julene Jordan on 101 WRIF. Let your opinion be heard. Call us at 313-298-WRIF.
Whatever's going on, it seems to be far from over.
Peter and Julene will be taking more of your calls right after this. This is Night Call on 101 WRIF. Voice your opinion at 313-298-WRIF. That's 313-298-9743. Now, here are Peter Werbe and Julene Jordan.
Hi, thank you very much, and welcome back to our final segment. Hey, if you got something to say, grab those phones, 313-298-WRIF. And here, and just like always feel, I should remember names, but the man that called in and said, why were we so biased against Republican? Where did this anger come from and all this? Yeah, you know, there was no need to begin the Iraq War. It was all based on lies. Doesn't everyone almost agree with that by now?
If they don't, then they have not come out from underneath the giant rock they live under.
One of the things that happens in war is that the psyche of the individuals that participate in it, what they see and what they experience, sometimes what they've done, and oftentimes it's young men. I mean, remember that whole thing in Vietnam, the average age was like 19.
Yeah.
Certainly in Iraq it's a lot higher, but still some of the crimes that American soldiers have committed, both in Iraq and Afghanistan, and part of that is just out of the rage that must fill them against the population, because it's not like one-on-one. They're not like fighting the Germans or something like that.
Yeah.
But anyway, violent sex crimes committed by active U.S. Army soldiers have almost doubled over the past 5 years, due in part to the trauma of war. This is more George Bush war criminal indictment material. Reported violent sex crimes increased by 90% over a five-year period from 2006 to 2011. There were almost 3,000 violent felonies in 2011, nearly half of which were violent felony sex crimes. Most were committed in the United States.
Wow.
And it said one violent sex crime was committed by a soldier every 6 hours and 40 minutes in 2011. This is according to the Army. And it served as the main driver for an overall increase in violent sex crimes. Higher rates of violent sex crimes are likely outcomes, they say, of intentional misconduct. Well, Hello?
Right.
I mean, what do you think? It was unintentional. Oh, I didn't know I was raping her. Lacks discipline, but here, this is what really is what's at issue here. Post-combat adrenaline, high levels of stress, and behavioral health issues.
Now, this story just pissed me off. And, you know, the thing is well, okay, I understand PTSD completely, absolutely. And I hope that every single soldier who comes back is given some type of counseling. But an excuse to rape women? What the hell?
Well, it's not an excuse. It's an explanation. Soldiers with PTSD are up to 3 times more likely to be aggressive with their female partner than those without such trauma. But here,
there's aggressive, Peter, and there's you know, verbal abuse and things like that. But then rape is a whole other animal. Yeah.
The report also said that family abuse cases are typically severely underreported. So this is another result, besides sinking our economy, besides killing almost 5,000 American soldiers, maybe anywhere from 100,000 to 500,000 Iraqis, all based on George Bush's lies. I mean, the man belongs in the docket of the International Criminal Court.
Oh, and he'll never
without
go.
Without a doubt.
He'll never go.
And also, and I thought this contained this in here, is that suicides are way up, too.
Yeah, and that one, hey, it's been happening, but now it is on the increase.
Right. Here is John. John's in Detroit. John, thanks for calling 313-298-WRIF. You're on the air. Hi.
Hi, thanks. I just wanted to comment. You were talking about at DTE and the electricity and gas in Detroit.
Yeah.
And I live with a relative, and the bill that she gets, it's for both gas and electricity.
You're right. The DTE does sell gas. I think if you're in Oakland County, you get it from Consumers Energy. Yeah. And I swear it used to be called Consumers Power, but I think energy now is more, you know, hip 21st century.
Yeah. But but not just they're raising their rates, but AT&T, all services, they've been sending out notices that they're going to raise their rates. The AT&T is threatening 9-15% or something like that.
Oh, you know, and what they've done, they've made some of these instruments, like for instance, iPhones, almost into a necessity. What begins as desire, it finally ends as a necessity. Or what begins as a plaything, you know, begins as a necessity. For automobiles, I mean, that was something when they began, only the wealthy had, and they were kind of like
televisions,
like
too.
Toy. Well, yeah, and then all of a sudden, you know, who can live without them? Well, these, you know, how can you now, almost in an area like Detroit, you know, get to your job if you don't have a car?
Yeah,
well,
especially with our public transportation
and,
system.
And everything is about distribution of wealth and income. So when you have these corporate bandits like ExxonMobil making more money than any corporation in the history of the world, you know they've gotten it from somewhere, and they've gotten it from you and me. They could charge us rather than $3.50 a gallon. I know some people want it real high to discourage driving. Because, you know, it's bad for the environment. You don't want to be, you know, having to deal with all this oil and all that. But there's other ways to deal with that. But anyway, there is a wealth transfer from the average person here and around the world when we fill up from us to these wealthy people that own ExxonMobil. And it's the same thing with all of this stuff. When AT&T raises rates, when whoever does, when the water board does, well, that's actually a public utility. But what's really needed, and we saw that with what bank was it? Was it Bank of America or Citibank when they started they were going to have these
Bank of America.
On debit withdrawals?
Yeah.
You know, they backed down.
They did.
And what they're counting on for us is our continued passivity, our continued acquiescence, that we'll call talk shows and say, that sucks, and not do another damn thing. And as I always say, you say, well, what am I going to do? I'm just a person.
Is anything. Do something.
Yeah. Well, sometimes it confounds somebody. You're mad as hell, don't want to take it anymore, and what do I do on Monday? Well, it's starting to happen. It's starting to percolate. The Occupy movement has begun to challenge how wealth is looted by the 1% from the 99% and beginning to create a movement that wants to challenge that. And that's what we got to do.
And we love that. Looks like we have...
Thank you, John.
We're full up on calls, but we have one open line if you want to call. We still have about, 15, 20 minutes left of the show. But, Peter, I really want to quick mention your guests that are coming up at 1 o'clock. Do you care if I do it?
No, go ahead.
Okay, David Bacon, author of How U.S. Policies Fueled Mexico's Great Migration. And this is from The Nation magazine, which is...
In a nutshell, it is that NAFTA destroyed the livelihood of Mexican farmers.
The small farmers
and ambitious men who wanted to provide for their families said, we got to go where the jobs are, which was here
in the United States. Yeah. And then you will be interviewing, or did interview, playing back one from Sean Stewart, editor, On the Ground, an illustrated anecdotal history of the 60s underground press in the U.S., which I love.
Yeah, before the Internet, guess what? People had their own little newspaper.
And you still have one.
Yeah.
The longest running.
Here is Dave. Dave doesn't say where you're from, but welcome. Where are you calling from?
Detroit.
Okay, go ahead. You're on the air.
Yeah, I have a comment on Iraq war.
Sure.
Yeah, the whole Iraq war operation was illegal, and it wasn't supposed to happen. The first thing how it started was when 9/11 occurred.
Right.
And Osama bin Laden was in a mountain in Afghanistan.
Bora Bora.
And George Bush, he went there to attack Osama bin Laden at the mountain. He had all the troops over there ready to kill him. Then he said, send all the troops to Iraq because this is weapons of mass destruction there.
Which there weren't any.
Yeah.
Right.
And he knew that. And and I knew that. And Jalene knew that. And Dave, probably you knew that.
Right.
So why in the world the American people fell for that is so far beyond me. All right, I'm going to rush a little through these, Dave. Thank you. I think you're absolutely right
because
we're getting close, but we can still sneak you in. Here's Don. Don's in St. Clair Shores. Go ahead, Don. You're on the air.
Hi, Peter. Hi, Joanne.
Hi.
I just had a comment on the whole PTSD and the aggravated assault on women issue. I was in from 06 to mid-08, and I was part of the surge back in 07 that President Bush pushed across. But, I mean, I'll admit I have it myself. A bunch of us do.
Yeah.
Everybody deals with it differently. I mean, it's from some people it can come out as anger issues. Some people it can be the opposite spectrum of emotional issues. Some people, it just all depends. But there are those that can't handle it, which, I mean, it's horrible to say, but I can understand why this is going on.
Well,
people come back, they see things that nobody sees. Period. And
but why does it always manifest itself in violence toward women? That's what pisses me off.
It's a whole stigma within the military culture as a whole. I mean, it's one of them things where you kind of have to participate to understand. The biggest fear a lot of guys have when they deploy is, well, there's the joke of Jody. And Jody is the guy that's doing your wife while you're overseas.
Huh.
And a lot of soldiers, I know quite a few myself, that this actually happened to. They deployed. Their women cheat on them with somebody else. They spend all their money on this other guy. Then they divorce them and still take everything.
Yeah, I've heard a lot of stories like that. If everyone would just have open marriages and be polyamorous, then maybe it'd be okay.
All kidding aside, Jillian.
I know.
I mean, it happens in all wars. The man's gone and someone else makes a pitch. But and what they used to call World War I, they called it shell-shocked that people experienced. What now we call PTSD.
But what about these women who may, they've got their own psychological stuff when their guys go over there. So maybe, deep down, I know this is not, there's no excuse, but maybe they think, well, maybe he's not coming back.
Well, there is.
I understand where you're coming from on that, but I mean, it's hard enough for us guys over there, and to know that she's doing that back home and betraying every trust you put into her, it's kind of tough.
Well, I suspect that probably, I hope, would be, the minority of the experiences. But Don, that I've heard just in specials that there is this resistance within the military for, active duty soldiers actually to seek help, to say, look, I'm suffering. I keep having recurrences of battle scenes, or I see people with their guts splattered all over that, or that, we shot these people and it turned out out to be a kid and not to who we thought it was, that they can't shake those images, and yet because of any kind of militaristic ethos has to be macho by its very nature, that they don't seek help. Huh?
Well, yeah, that makes sense. But a lot of guys will tell you they don't want to go seek the help because the instant stigma you get is, oh, you're faking it to try to get out of something.
Well, yeah, yeah.
Mm-hmm. And or you're just weak and you're a poon and you just can't hang. I mean, it's tough and overall just because of the people, the mentality of it as a whole.
Now, well, you're suffering from PTSD as well. Have you been offered help through the United States government, the Defense Department?
It's there. I haven't seeked it because personally I feel I can control it. But others, I know others that have seeked this help, and they do readily use it.
Well, let's do this, Don. We're getting towards the end of the show, and we have somebody who's a specialist in the Army waiting. So thank you for your comments, and that's who we're getting it most from the people that experienced it. Here, hi, you're on the air. You don't want to identify yourself, which is fine. Go ahead.
Yes, sir. I'm currently a specialist in the Army, so I don't know who's quite listening. Basically, when you come back, at least in my unit, they sit you down. It's called demobilization process. They sit you down. They ask you, you see a Army psychologist or civilian, depending on the situation. They go, hey, how you doing? Do you think you need help? And just like the last caller said, nobody wants to say, yeah, I need help. I need help. Because there's that stigma. If you need help, if, you know, you're just trying to get out of something or you're faking it or this, that, and the other. But it's so laxed. A, the Army standards, because of the war and the surge, they just let almost anybody in. The guys I served with or still do serve with, it's kind of scary that they're actually in and holding rifles next to me. Also, when, like, the stigma is, do you need help? No. Okay, move on. And they,
yeah.
It's all about filing the paperwork and just checking the boxes. That's all it's about.
Well, I hear you, but I wonder what they, the way you're portraying it, probably accurately, since you were there, in a real casual manner. I mean, I suppose they would have to do some pretty in-depth interviews to really get out of people, because very particularly with psychological problems, when you say to somebody, how you doing, and even though inside the level of anxiety or panic or fear or rage or what have you, and someone says, how you doing, you say, I'm okay, right? I mean, that whether you're in the service or not. And to really get and
it's more than checking a box. Do you need help or not?
Yeah, but let me ask you: did you see combat?
Yes.
So I mean, how do you fit into it all? I mean, now that it's over.
I'll tell you what: it is a coming back, especially the first day. You realize that you love things, the small things that you've really never ever even thought about, like the smell of grass, per se, and, you know, you realize how much you've changed, and you got to realize the world's changed without you. It's really hard, and honestly,
life just goes on, even though you're over there, right?
Exactly, and honestly, it really is. Hey, they sit you down with the Army psychologist or whatnot, and, hey, do you need help? Nope. All right, move on. And they need either better psychologists or they need something to where they can actually have a full-blown interview.
I think it should be a whole, like a program that you go through, not just one short interview kind of question-answer thing.
Yeah, because you know, we always, and I think this is correct, I mean, we think about the victim. So if you're talking about the victims of violent sex crimes by men suffering from PTSD, that's who we center on. But imagine what must go through the mind of the perpetrator, that they've turned on their family, that they've injured the people that should be the core unit in their life. So, I'm not making any excuses for anybody's behavior,
yeah.
But it's all just tragic. All right, I have to move on. Hey, you stay safe.
Not allowed in.
Okay, you stay safe, okay?
Goodbye.
All right. Bye-bye.
Thanks for calling.
Yeah. Let's see. Here's more. Here's Josh in Garden City. Hi, Josh. You're on the air.
Hey, guys. Good to talk to you again.
Thanks.
Hey, you too. Hi, Josh.
I was in the military from 94 to 98, so, you know, relatively peacetime era, but, you know, we did do some UN police action, which was no fun.
We're like Bosnia?
Yeah, basically. But the problem is when you come back, they just throw you out into the world. They don't really care, or pump you full of drugs, which is no better.
Yeah.
You know, that's what they do. And the problem is there's no deprogramming program. Once you program someone how to kill, how do you take it back?
No, it is difficult. And that's, that's why that military action should be used so sparingly rather than, oh, hey, some medical students are allegedly having a bad time in Grenada. Let's send the troops in. You know, in the meantime, somebody, the guys that are sending them in increasingly have never been in combat. I mean, I wonder how many presidents who actually saw combat. I mean, President Kennedy did. I'm trying to think.
Roosevelt.
No, Roosevelt never did. Roosevelt was, remember, he had polio. He was paralyzed.
No, Theodore.
Oh, Theodore. Yeah, the Rough Riders.
Yeah.
Charging up San Juan Hill. I was on San Juan Hill, actually.
Yeah.
Must have been a few others. Oh, yeah, there was, Andrew Jackson, the great, what was he? Oh, Indian killer, right. George Washington.
Oh,
God. Yeah. So you know, but that's my point. It's the government, like when I got out, they didn't care. They just go out, go live your life, do whatever, go back to normal life.
Yeah, and no best of luck to you.
You know, it's sort of like a factory. I mean, you know what I mean? It's just, you're there to make the product.
I mean, heck, we even have a program to rehabilitate abused animals. Why can't we do that with our soldiers?
Well, every once in a while when I hear, I'm the public affairs director for the greater media stations here, including WRIF, and every once in a while I'll get a request for a public service announcement for some benefit for soldiers. And I'm thinking, I'm pleased to do it, but I'm thinking, why in the world should private citizens have to have a bowling alley benefit for soldiers rather than the government saying, hey, here's everything under the sun for you because what we sent you into.
Yeah, and all of these organizations specifically designed for Iraq veterans and people who need that little extra help that the government just is not giving them.
Because once you're no longer taking orders, you're no longer useful.
See you later. Thanks for all your service.
Thank you, Josh. Appreciate it. Here's Daryl in Ann Arbor. Go ahead. You're on the air, Daryl.
Hello. I'm on hold waiting. I was also on in the service. I was in the Navy. And I was actually on board the USS Cole during when it was bombed. So PTSD hit me as well. But I found it a little bit different. The assessment process wasn't just a question and answer. There were classic physical signs, especially for a sailor or soldier. There were things that they looked at just as you came in. Were you clean shaven? Was your uniform squared away? That kind of thing. So there was more to it than just question and answers. And they did it for us, at least. We had several surveys that they gave us several times. Like, they kept coming at us to make sure that we weren't losing our minds and going a little crazy. PTSD, of course, was around. It was kind of new around that time.
So you're saying that I forgot which of the people we spoke to was saying that you think it's a little more.
Maybe it depends on the branch of the Army and their different.
Yeah. I always thought
of the military. I mean,
right. It very well could be. There's lots of different changes there. But my original reason for calling is because of the rape thing. I'm a student now and studying rape currently. And
you're studying rape?
You're studying rape?
I'm criminal justice.
Oh, okay. Student.
Okay.
So yeah. I got a big paper about rape that I got to do.
Oh.
So Uniform Crime Report from the FBI in 2010 said that there were approximately 85,000 rapes nationwide. And that comes from the law enforcement agencies throughout the country. Well, to put in another perspective, the victimization survey that goes out, I don't believe it's the FBI who does this, but it goes out throughout the country as well. But 100 and I think it was 166,000 victims reported rape. So there's a huge difference on what is reported and what isn't. And it comes to 1 in 10 to actually get reported. And about 89% of those are also acquaintance rapes, not stranger rapes.
Well, so, you know what I don't understand, because and what I always tell men is that everyone has some woman in their life that they love. You know, if it's not a wife or a girlfriend, it's a mother, it's
mom,
a sister, you know, somebody like that. And to participate in a culture of sexual violence put the people you love, the women that you love, at risk as well. Because, I mean, even a rapist would be enraged if someone attacked, you know,
their
a woman.
Family member.
Yeah, their family member, huh?
Right, right. And it's even worse. Sex offenders don't age out. And that's most crimes you age out when you get a little bit older. Just, it doesn't appeal to you anymore. Well, sex offense usually does not. And so sex offenders, once a sex offender, you're usually deemed a sex offender for life, too. So
Well, Daryl, in your studies, I doubt if you have much time for reading fiction, but a friend of mine, Kara Hoffman, C-A-R-A Hoffman, wrote a book, a novel called So Much Pretty, that is about male violence. Actually, it's a disturbing book.
I'm not reading it.
No, I mean, I'll tell you, if it wouldn't have been a friend of ours, I don't even know if I would have read it. Very well written. It was nominated for the National Book Award.
Wow.
And everything like that. And interviewing her, when it came out, Simon & Schuster book, I interviewed her, and I said, why are men so angry, or so many men so angry at women? And why are they so filled with rage? And she said, they're angry at everyone, but it's just that women are the weakest targets.
Yeah.
And kids
as well.
It's easy
to take advantage and do that kind of thing.
You know, Daryl, you're our last caller. And I just turned myself. That was a Freudian sleep. I mean, but thank you.
That's a first, too.
Thank you, Daryl. I turned my own mic off.
I know there are a few people out there who probably like that.
say goodnight, Peter. Good night, Peter.
Good night, Peter.
Yeah, and thanks to all of you for listening and calling. Athena and Sarah, thank you so much. And thank them as well for putting our show up as a podcast. It'll be there by noon, so that's 11 hours from now.
It's also free, and it's available 24/7.
Yeah, and got a couple of great interviews. Going to start with one that I did about the 1960s underground press.
Cool, man.
We'll talk next week.
This is Night Call on 101 WRIF. Peter will be right back with more Night Call right after this. WRIF and WRIF HD1 Detroit.
We're back with more Night Call on 101 WRIF Detroit. Here's Peter Werby.
Thank you very much for joining me. Peter Werby here with you. You know, I have to kind of bring up a little history to younger people in the audience. There once was a time, I know this is hard to believe, when there was not an internet, where you couldn't immediately contact people through Twitter or Facebook or, you know, email, stuff like that. You couldn't get information on almost anything by going to Google or other search engines or stuff like that. But all throughout American history, and of course other countries as well, groups that were outside of the mainstream had to communicate, and they're people wrote letters by hand, and people then later on typewrote letters. But also that beginning with the Revolutionary War movement and all throughout our history, newspapers were the primary manner in which dissidents communicated. The abolitionists and the suffragettes and the union movement, the anti-war movements, the gay movement, all of this, all was communicated through newspapers, done by the people themselves very frequently. And probably the most prominent, at least in our, well, in our, let's say, sort of our general lifetime, because some of this may have happened before some of you were born, was what was called the Underground Press. And the Underground Press were a series of newspapers that were available all over the country during the 1960s and into the 1970s, to the point in the United States that there were over 500 regularly appearing newspapers, millions of readers. And, in fact, one of them began right here in Detroit, the Fifth Estate. And full disclosure, I should say that I've worked with the Fifth Estate newspaper, now a magazine, for years and years. And there's a great chronicling of all of this in an anecdotal manner. That is, people involved in it tell their own stories. The book is called On the Ground, an Illustrated Anecdotal History of the 60s Underground Press in the U.S. It's edited by Sean Stewart, and Sean Stewart is my guest. He's taken these interviews with so many people and explains what the Underground Press of the 1960s was. And it's beautiful, just all of the graphics that are reproduced here, all the drawings, all photographs, what have you. And Sean Stewart grew up in Kingston, Jamaica. Between 2007 and 2009, he owned and operated Babylon Falling. It was a bookstore and gallery in San Francisco. We're reaching him right now at his home in Brooklyn. Sean Stewart, welcome to the Peter Werby Show.
Thank you, sir. It's good to be here.
Yeah, hey, I assume that if you were alive during the 1960s, you weren't real old.
No, and I wasn't. I wasn't. I was born in 79.
Okay. So what got you interested in all this, to look back? I mean, you could have done the 30s. You could have done the teens and the 20th century. Why the Underground Press of the 60s?
You know, it's something that I've been trying to nail down, a single reason and a single event that put me on the trail of the Underground Press and 60s history. But it's really just a series of things, and it started in Jamaica, just being a collector, just, you know, a little troublemaker kid collecting Mad magazines wherever I could find them in Jamaica. And it has become this, you know, organic process. And, you know, one of the things I've been telling people is that, you know, I was always interested in the 60s history and just in American counterculture in general, but the history that I was getting, the story that I was getting, just wasn't grabbing me. And it wasn't until I started finding the underground newspapers in, you know, at flea markets, stuff like that, in old used bookstores, it really started to unfold the decade. And over time, it just, you know, it became an obsession, really. You know, I've been legitimized now that I have the book out, but for many years, I was just a simple hoarder of these newspapers.
And maybe we should tell people, too, that these papers were associated with the anti-war movement, the New Left, what were called the hippies, feminism, gays. In other words, it was the quintessential press of the 1960s. It expressed what was happening in that decade. But go ahead. I'm curious. You did find these dusty old papers in resale shops and what have you, huh?
Yeah, just you know, one by one, I would find these papers, and for me, the covers are what drew me in. But when I actually opened the papers, it was like turning over a rock, and you see this whole ecosystem that just kind of emerges. And it was fascinating to me because, like I said, I had known about the 60s, but you know, I only knew about, I guess, the most surface details. And as I read these papers, you know, a whole new story unfolded for me. It was this really rich, diverse, you know, just, I mean, it was, it actually was amazing. And that's what I wanted to do with the book, is to, as close as possible, as best as possible, to reproduce that experience. And there's a line in here from John Sinclair, and he says, you know, what people get from the 60s are, you know, what was number one on the charts. And that was my experience until I found the papers.
Huh. Well, I wonder also, I'm fearful sometimes that when you bring up the 60s to younger people, that their eyes just roll and they think, oh, yeah, here go these middle-aged and now older guys with big pot bellies and gray beards. And, yeah, the 60s. Do you get any sense of how the 60s in general play with your generation? I mean, are you unusual in terms of your interest?
I think I'm unusual in terms of the level of my obsession and involvement, but I do find that the resonance exists if it's presented in the way, you know, that I've presented in the book. And then also, you know, I have a website, BabylonFallen.com, where I post excerpts and scans from these newspapers, and I have a considerable amount of followers who are my age and then also younger, like 14-year-old kids. And so I think the resonance is there. It's just, it's strictly in how it's presented. The spirit is the same, and you see it manifesting today with the Occupy movement. It's a lot of similar sentiment being expressed there. So I think that spirit of rebellion is something that's very American and always present.
The book is On the Ground, an illustrated anecdotal history of the 60s underground press in the United States. And this were dissident journals that grew to 500 regularly appearing newspapers and hundreds and maybe even thousands of irregular published different what we call now zines or little newsletters and what have you. Sean Stewart edited a number of quite a few anecdotal histories from people that actually made it go. And I said a couple of times that the graphics in it are absolutely amazing. They maybe take up about half of the book itself. And so tell me, you must have had access to all these papers, because there's so many of them. I mean, every newspaper under the sun. In fact, I should say, more full disclosure, there's even a photograph of me in there, isn't
yes.
there? On page 7,
yes.
on 17.
17.
Yeah, I was only 8 years old then. No, I'm only kidding. I was only kidding.
Right.
But so how did you just, as you said, just went out and collected these, found these, and saved them, and then were able to scan them and put them in the book?
Yeah, right? I mean, basically the overwhelming majority of the paper, of the images in the book, are from my own collection, and that's what allows for the full color reproduction, as opposed to some of the other books out there who rely on the microfilm copies, so they're, you know, black and white and, you know, not the best reproductions. But yeah, so the majority of them are from my collection, and then also from other private collectors and people who had held on to their papers that they were members of since the 60s. Had loaned me papers to scan as well. So
I'll give you a quick anecdote, and that is in Detroit, besides the Fifth Estate and a number of other publications, some published by John Sinclair, the Ann Arbor Sun, and why can't I even remember all of them? The Warren Forest Sun that John Sinclair put out as well. But there was a broadsheet called Guerrilla, you know, Guerrilla, and published by Alan Van Newkirk. It was a broadsheet, and it was called A Free Newspaper of the Streets. And I've just looked for it online, and now they want for the free newspaper of the streets. Now that people are trying to sell them for $200 a copy.
right.
So
yeah,
history moves on. Yeah, but, you know, this is published, I should say, by PM Press, a wonderful imprint. PMPress.org is where you can look at their incredible titles. And they must have thought a lot of this, because all of this full-color reproduction that you mentioned is not cheap. Usually books, you know, you have a color cover, and then it's all black and white on the inside. I mean, this is an amazing array of the colors that that show the kind of creativity that occurred. You know, on page 282, you have this Armed Love from the MF tribe, Black Elk Speaks, And
right.
And it's got this. I wonder if you could speak a little about the cover and what was called a split fountain and how they produced this this bizarre kind of coloration that you rarely ever see. I don't think you see it today even.
It's not a technique that you see really use very much outside of, you know, the fine art world. Or, you know, really small art prints. But, you know, from my understanding, it's, and I'm no expert, it must be said, it was basically a manipulation of the offset process and basically a way to expand the range of colors used by blending the basically four primary colors to create new colors.
Yeah.
Simplest terms, I guess.
Yeah.
But, you know, and then this image that you're speaking of was a center spread from Rat Subterranean News, and as you pointed out, it was from the Armed Love MF Tribe, which is the shortened, censored version of what their real name was. And you know, they were basically, they've been called a street gang with analysis, but they were a street gang of artists on the Lower East Side of New York City. And you know, again, just another example of history that was, you know, is fascinating. Was, you know, important, significant to the era, but which you don't really get, you know. It's just, I mean, there are so many stories and so many aspects, so many facets of that era that are represented in the underground press, but which, you know, we know nothing about. And I say we, you know, in the sense, you know, as just a regular, I don't know.
Well, the importance of it, like so many history, is the preservation of memory. Because remember in 1984 that the anti-heroes' task was to throw things down the memory hole. And if people don't know that activity like this that's reported and the form of it itself, and the fact that a lot of it was done by 18 and 19 and 20-year-old people and younger people as well, that it is possible to do this. Now, the subtitle of your book, On the Ground, an Illustrated Anecdotal History of the 60s Underground Press in the U.S., it's the story told by the people that were involved. And are these people that you all interviewed yourself?
Yeah, these are people I interviewed myself, and I would say about half of it was done in person and half over the phone. And, you know, it was important for me to underscore that it is anecdotal, that this isn't meant to be a scholarly study. You know, and there are some fine ones out there. But, yeah, it was strictly I wanted to get people's stories. And you asked earlier how I came to be interested in the underground press. And one of the things that really tipped it over for me from just, you know, kind of like this amateur appreciation of this stuff into wanting to produce a book, was that when I had my store in San Francisco, which was a quote-unquote revolutionary bookstore, I was meeting these people who were involved with the papers, and, you know, they were sharing their anecdotes with me off the record, and it just blew my mind. As I said before, it was just another, you know, another aspect of the story that I had just never heard about and that I found was just much more instrumental, much more representative of what I felt it was like, you know, on the ground, I guess. And there goes the title of the book.
Sure.
But, yeah, so I knew I had to reproduce the stories and remove my voice, you know, because my voice, I felt, you know, at least overtly was not important, was about preserving these stories as they were lived and as they have been remembered. So, yeah,
My guess is Sean Stewart. He's done the editing of these anecdotal histories, also reproduced all of these excerpts, the visual excerpts from the underground press of the 1960s. You know, I was pleased to see a lot of these guys are still alive, and I'm trying to remember now. I mean, the first five underground papers in 1965, was the Los Angeles Free Press, which actually was begun in 1964. Then you had Detroit's Fifth Estate. You had a paper from East Lansing called The Paper, the Berkeley Barb, and wasn't there a fifth? There was a fifth one, but that escapes me right now. Art Kunkin was the editor of the L.A. Press. How do you track down Art Kunkin? I haven't even heard that name in 20 years.
Well, first of all, the fifth paper was the East Village Other.
Oh, that's right.
Out of New York. And then Kunkin, actually, I don't remember how I got his contact info, but he is out there because he's actually a practicing alchemist. And so he, And I think he still holds the copyright to the LA Free Press title, and he's tried to revive it a number of times. So his info is out there. And I reached out to him and had this amazing, actually a long, long conversation. And, you know, you talked earlier about the cutting room floor, and there's just so much stuff that actually isn't included that I wish I could have fit into the narrative. But Kunkin is this amazing figure. I mean, he's an octogenarian. I think he's 84, 85 now, and still kicking. You know?
That's great.
And yeah, he was one of the older guys at the time. You know, he was his father figure. You know, you talk about the fact that it was a youth-oriented movement. You know, and you know, I guess he's younger than I am now, but was seen as, you know, one of the elders.
Sure. That we mentioned earlier that there were 500 regularly appearing underground newspapers in the 1960s. And by the way, folks, I mean, everybody like in town knows the Real Detroit and the Metro Times. These papers really were the prototype for them, although they weren't filled with the ads. You know, they weren't 70, 80 pages long, but they were weekly. The Fifth Estate newspaper at that time, 1969, 1970, was a weekly, and a biweekly came out every 2 weeks. Comes out every three times a year now. But actually, Detroit's Fifth Estate, Sean, you may know this, is the only remaining paper from that era here in the Motor City. You can go to Fifth Estate. fifthestate.org. And your website is babylonfalling.com?
Babylonfalling.com, yes.
Yeah, and also there'll be a link on my website, Peter Werbe, W-E-R-B-E.com. Now, I thought, when we were talking about the circulation, into the millions a week, now here we're in the middle of a civil rights movement where the United States is at war. The whole establishment press just supports everything, you know, well, that's it. It supported the establishment of what was. So all of these papers were rebellious papers, as Sean Stewart said. And so there was problems with printers. Sometimes you couldn't get your newspaper printed. But the circulation was absolutely intense. I think the Fifth Estate in Detroit only got up to about 20,000 a week. And that's paid. You know, this is selling it, not a throwaway or giveaway like the Metro Times or Real Detroit. But some of them were even larger, like the L.A. Free Press. But maybe the biggest one was the Black Panther Party paper, you think?
I think so. It probably in sheer numbers. I know the Barb was pushing some serious numbers, but
the Berkeley,
The Panther paper at its height was up there. I've heard figures that range, you know, from 100,000 to 250,000. And remember, they were weekly, so it, you know, that's, you know, four times a month. But yeah, so that was up there, and I actually included testimony from three different Panthers in the book. And traditionally, they've been kind of left out of the narrative of the history of the underground press, and kind of relegated to the sidelines for some legitimate reasons. But in, you know, as I went through the papers myself, I felt it would be criminal to not include them because they were so obviously part of the scene. So I have even examples in here of, you know, other papers that are considered part of the underground press proper that would, you know, reproduce work from the Black Panther paper, artwork by Emery Douglas, that type of stuff.
Yeah,
I have a paper. I have a paper from Houston. You know, front cover, Huey is Free. So,
yeah. Well, that referred to the chairman of the Black Panther Party, which was Huey Newton, and that everybody was on board at that time with Free Huey. Emery Douglas, who was the graphic artist and minister of culture for the Black Panther Party, is represented both telling stories and a lot of his artwork. And sometimes we talk about now the level of political rhetoric in this in this political era. Well, when you read the Black Panther paper, it makes all of us sound kind of like Quakers by comparison, doesn't it?
right, definitely. And they introduced, you know, they're proud of introducing some vocabulary into the Black community and into the culture at large, terms like fascist, you know. But yeah, the propaganda was was not subtle, that's for sure.
Yeah, they might have done power to the people, too. I wonder if that was their phrase. That very well could have been. But also, as the 60s starts bearing in on the 70s, more papers that are more specific, feminist papers, gay papers, mm-hmm. Make their appearance in time, and also in your book, On the Ground. Can you tell us a little about those?
Yeah, definitely. As the as the years wore on, I mean, it was only natural that the papers would evolve to include voices from various groups, and then eventually these various groups would want their own voice or to distribute their own voice, and these papers started to come out. The rise of identity politics, but so there were feminist papers and gay papers and so on, and it basically was a part of the evolution of the underground press. It kind of heralded the end of the underground press era, but also it was so necessary at the same time. So
I wonder if you, and this might be a toughie, why you have this underground press, 500 regularly appearing newspapers in U.S. cities, millions of readers, and it was like it was like the passenger pigeon. It's like there one day, boom, just almost crashes. And as I said, all of them except for the Fifth Estate that's still published in Detroit. What did any of them speak to why the collapse occurred?
Yeah, different people had different ideas about why the era ended, and almost one of the common themes that almost everyone talked about was the amount of repression and then the burnout that comes on the heels of that repression. And basically times were changing, and no one really talked about it too much in the book, but from my perspective, a large part of it is the fact that it was youth oriented, and a lot of it was centered around campuses across the country, and that has a built-in shelf life of 4 years. So you get a couple overlapping generations, and people begin to move into their lives, find jobs, settle down, that type of thing. But I think the repression really is a big part of the story.
Yeah,
in terms. Yeah.
Well,
And then behind all of that too is the end of the draft. I think that was a huge factor in removing some of the urgency for some of the, some of the sympathy, the broad based sympathy, and the broad audience. So.
And the war and essentially the Vietnam, what they call the Vietnamization of the war in Vietnam. Also, 1972 was very important. That was the re-election of Richard Nixon. The most reviled figure among the new left, the anti-war movement, everyone left of center, and it was so shocking that that people would vote for for a president that was seen as a war criminal, and I think that just took the wind out of a lot of sails. Well, we're almost at an end, and I always feel that discussions like this go by so quickly, but that's why people write books. This book is called On the Ground, an illustrated anecdotal history of the 60s underground press in the U.S. My guest is Sean Stewart, and he edited it. Again, I want to emphasize PM Press, pmpress.org. Terrific titles there. Is this a one-off for Sean Stewart? Where do you go with all of this? You've kind of chronicled this. You needed a book, of course, about 600 pages long, didn't you?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I have, I mentioned my website, and I'll probably be releasing some of the cutting room floor stuff online over time. But a lot more work needs to be done on the 60s Underground Press. I don't have a specific project at this point, but my interest isn't going to wane at any time, So I'm positive that I'll continue trying to revive the history or extract some of the stories from all of the veterans of the era.
Well, that's great. Emory Douglas, who I mentioned was the Black Panther Party graphic artist and minister of culture, said one should not underestimate the significant value of this book. It gives you real insights into the underground press and its vast diversity of publications, which translated into a taste of real people's power. And in many ways, and that's what you said, Sean Stewart, it sort of presaged the Occupy movement of today. The book is On the Ground, an illustrated anecdotal history of the 60s underground press in the U.S. You can go to BabylonFalling.com. You can check it out there. PMPress.org, which I would recommend as well. And a link on my website, which is Peter Werbe, W-E-R-B-E.com. Sean Stewart, it's been great. Thanks a lot. Thanks for being on the broadcast.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me.
This is Night Call on 101 WRIF. Peter will be right back with another guest right after this. Now, Night Call is back on 101 WRIF Detroit. Here's your host, Peter Werbe.
Thank you very much for joining me. Peter Werbe here with you. Used to be when we heard about Mexico and Mexicans coming to the United States, it was all about migration and illegal migration, as it's called, and the illegals as the people that entered the United States to seek work, given that that economy had been so devastated by NAFTA, something we're going to talk about. Now it's just all about the drug war. And there were some people, including a listener to this station, I hope he's listening, but he used to say that, you know, there was going to wind up to be 30 million illegal immigrants here. And he said, when is it going to be enough for you, Pete? He would write this to me. And this consumed almost his whole being, that we were going to be overrun by this brown horde or something like that. Well, that issue has not gone away, but it's diminished, at least in the public consciousness. And the go-to person when you want to talk about migration, when you want to talk about the issues that involve workers coming from Mexico, both legal and illegal, is David Bacon. He's a former union organizer and a fellow at the Oakland Institute. He's a writer and a photographer, the author of, and this may be what I last interviewed him about, The Children of NAFTA, Labor Wars on the U.S.-Mexico Border. He's written other books since then, including Communities Without Borders. That was 2006. And a good one, Illegal People, How Globalization Creates Migration and Criminalizes Immigrants. And this is kind of the key to it all. Now, what drove me to David's work in this regard lately, although I see his stuff all the time, is an article in the January 4th Nation magazine. It's called How U.S. Policies Fueled Mexico's Great Migration. And, well, I should bring David in on this because I've got my opinions, but hell, why do I have guests? David Bacon, we're reaching him at his office in Oakland, California. Hi, David, and welcome back to the Peter Werbe Show.
Well, thanks for having me, Peter.
Well, this is unusual that in the sense that migration to the United States from North America, from Mexico and from Central America and even some from South America is treated as caused by the U.S. Usually we think it's these people that don't belong here that are coming and stealing our jobs. What's wrong with that picture and how does that fit in to your article, How U.S. Policies Fueled Mexico's Great Migration?
Well, Peter, I used to be, as you said, a union organizer for the Molders Union, which was people who work in foundries, and for the Garment Workers Union. And I know from my experience that many of us here in the United States, working people, know that we lost jobs because of the North American Free Trade Agreement. All you have to do is look around in the streets of Detroit or Flint or Oakland, where I live and work, and you can see the shuttered factories. And in many cases, we know that the jobs in those factories went down south below the border to the kind of notorious maquiladoras, those low-wage factories or sweatshops down there. And, in fact, that's true. You know, we did. We lost 811,000 jobs, according to the Economic Policy Institute and the U.S. Department of Labor. That is, until President Bush told them to stop counting because it was an embarrassing statistic when he was running for re-election in 2004. What many people conclude from that, though, is that, okay, we lost those jobs, therefore Mexicans got those jobs, therefore why are they coming here? You know, they must be greedy after all. You know, they got the jobs.
They went to Mexico. In other words, they went to Mexico.
That's right.
Yeah, why
would they? Jobs went to Mexico, why are the Mexicans coming here? And especially politicians play on this by saying, well, you know, Mexicans are coming here to scam the system, to game the system, to get welfare or to get food stamps or to get free medical care or so forth. Actually, you know, that in itself is kind of a just pretty obviously untrue, since people who are here without papers can't get any of those things.
Right.
But the real point, though, is that we don't see very clearly here what happened to Mexico in that period of time, in the period of time that NAFTA has been in effect. I guess you could sort of like take a leaf out of the Occupy book here and say that NAFTA was a treaty to benefit the 1% and that hurt the 99%, regardless of which side of the border people were on. In other words, U.S. corporations got richer by relocating production to Mexico. That's the 1%. The 1% in Mexico got richer by the fact that Mexico privatized all kinds of, you know, public enterprises, and Carlos Slim became one of the wealthiest people in the world by buying the telephone system there for pennies. But we know that here in the U.S., the 99% us, we lost out because we lost jobs. In Mexico, the 99% lost out too. So what that article in The Nation does is it looks at one example of how that happened.
That's in the in Veracruz. You
that's right.
And David Bacon, you went to Veracruz for this article.
Oh, I did. I went to Veracruz and I went to Tar Heel, North Carolina, because what I was doing is I was investigating Smithfield Foods, which is the largest pork producer in the world. And they also run the largest pork slaughterhouse in the world in Tar Heel, North Carolina, where workers spent 16 years battling this very, very anti-union company, trying to organize a union in that plant to raise their wages.
Well, let me get a little piece of information here. One of the charges is, of course, is that union work was centered in many cases in slaughterhouses, that it was mostly unionized. It was white males that staffed it. And this is in cattle in Nebraska, in North Carolina, hogs. And suddenly it's Somalis, immigrants working in Nebraska and in Tar Heel and other places in North Carolina. It's all sorts of immigrants, a virtual United Nations. So the perception would be, wait a minute, we had our kind of core of the American working class, white men, doing it, and suddenly everything changes in terms of nationality and color and gender and what have you. So empirically, it would seem, quote, the big they, have taken, quote, our jobs.
Well, what really happened during the late 1970s and the 1980s was the busting of unions in the meatpacking industry. Huge sections of the meatpacking industry went non-union. The old union companies like Smith and Cudahy disappeared. And the new companies that grew up in their place, Iowa Beef Processors, Tyson, and Smithfield, for that matter, were overwhelmingly non-union companies. You know, the meatpacking industry was like the auto industry, built on immigrant labor, people who came here from somewhere else. So the same people that organized the union in the 1930s and the 1940s, they were people who often came from Mexico or came from countries in Europe or came from all over the world. You know, the meatpacking industry has always had a kind of an international workforce. The big change that happened was this restructuring of the industry and the busting of unions. And since then, what we've seen is the efforts by people in those plants to reorganize the unions and pull their wages back up again, because meatpacking companies kept the wages at 1980 levels for over 20 years. So meatpacking, which used to pay better than the average U.S. factory wage, by 2000 was paying about 25% less. So people have tried to organize unions there, and that means all the people in those plants were trying to organize unions. And the article tells the story of the organizing drive in Tar Heel, which was a cooperative effort by African-American workers and by Mexicans, because that's who worked in that plant. So part of the article is about how Smithfield and the MIGRA, the immigration authorities, got together to try to essentially terrorize the Mexican workers to keep that union effort from succeeding. And they were successful, actually, for a while, because they fired a number of workers because supposedly they had bad Social Security numbers. They had a couple of raids in there, picked up people for deportation. Everybody got really terrified as a result of that. And the union organizing effort in that plant basically came to a halt. Well, that didn't just hurt the Mexicans in that plant who had been trying to organize the union. It also hurt the African-American workers who were trying to organize the union, too, for the same reasons, because everybody was being hurt by the low wages and by the high incidence of injuries on those lines because they were running those lines so, so fast. So
well, David,
after a while...
Let me interrupt just a second. I'm interrupting you, so I should say I'm sorry. I'm interviewing on the Peter Werby Show, David Bacon. He's the author of an article that appeared in the January 4th Nation magazine, How U.S. Policies Fueled Mexico's Great Migration. And David visited both Veracruz, Mexico, and also Tar Heel, North Carolina. Tar Heel is the home of Smithfield Foods. And one of the things in this, I'm curious, you can understand why no employer wants unions because they have to pay better wages and they have to pay better benefits. Why would the United States government, its agency, aid in an anti-union effort by a corporation, a multi-billion dollar corporation? What's the reasoning there?
Well, I think for two reasons. One is that there is a sort of an anti-union bias in the Immigration and Customs Enforcement Agency, and there always has been, going back to the days when it was the INS, the Immigration and Naturalization Service. They always tended to go after union companies and especially immigrant workers when they tried to organize unions. So this is hardly the first or the only example of their doing that. But they were also implementing a national policy, which was a policy that has gone on under both, you know, Republican and Democratic administrations, which was essentially to try to enforce immigration laws in the workplace in a way that deprives workers of their rights, deprives them of their ability to organize and to change conditions. And that, I think, is the key thing to look at. Because when they went into that plant, and this is not just the story of Smithfield and Tar Heel, this is the story of many, many, many union organizing efforts, janitors, hotel workers, and so on. When they went into that plant and they conducted that immigration raid, it didn't help African American workers. It didn't help people who were citizens. It hurt them. It hurt them because what it did was it made it much more difficult for them to organize the union. And it was only when those workers were able to reach out to each other across those lines of race and nationality and language and say to each other, hey, we all work here in this plant, we all have a right to be here, and we're all going to get together and do what we have to do in order to raise the wages here and get the union in, that they finally did win a union election in 2008.
Well, David Bacon, let me
16 years.
16 years. Wow. Well, let me ask you this, and this might occur to people. You say of the right to organize. If these people are in the country other than under legal circumstance, pretty easy for people to say, well, wait a minute. My ancestors came from Czechoslovakia or Italy or France or wherever, Canada even, and they said they went through the immigration process. They were processed. They were legal. Why should we grant anything to someone who's in this country that has violated the laws by entering it?
Well, the first answer to that is because it's in our interest as workers to do that. You know, when any group of workers in our workforce gets deprived of their rights and can't organize, that hurts everybody. That's why we fought against color lines. That's why we fought for anti-discrimination laws, was because we wanted to have a situation in which all working people in this country have rights, especially the right to organize and to make conditions better. Because if we can't organize, then what happens is that our conditions and our wages get driven down to the bottom. But the other answer to that question, Peter, is that immigration, the process for coming to this country has changed many, many times over the last 200 years, actually more than that. People were brought here in chains from Africa as slaves. Remember, that's, you know, a long, even longer ago than that. You know, that was an immigration policy, too. When people came here from Europe at, you know, in the last part of the 1800s, for instance, all the way up through 1920, all the way up through World War One. There were no visas. You bought a ticket. You got on the boat in Europe. You came over to the United States here. You got off at Ellis Island. You know, the inspector at Ellis Island looked at you to make sure that you weren't sick and asked you what your name was. And, of course, that's the classic story of how people with, you know, Polish names and Italian names became Smith and Jones because the immigration inspectors couldn't pronounce the names right. And then you got on the ferry, you went into New York City, and you started looking for a job. That's not what the immigration process is any longer. In fact, even at that time, that was the immigration process for people crossing the Atlantic coming from Europe. At the same time, the process for people crossing the Pacific coming from China was very, very, very different. And we have an island here in San Francisco Bay, Angel Island, where people were sometimes held for years in a very tortuous immigration process that was essentially designed to keep them out. So it was a racialized immigration policy in which there were certain rules for people who came from one set of countries, namely European countries or countries where, you know, white people were coming from, and another policy for people who were coming from Asia, specifically in that case, or even from Mexico and Latin America. So all I'm saying here, Peter, is that there's nothing wrong with having an immigration policy. In fact, we should have an immigration policy that treats people fairly, and that allows people to come and reunite their families here, which is what the purpose of our immigration policy supposedly has been since the days of the Civil Rights Movement when we changed our immigration laws to make that possible. The problem is that it doesn't work right now because they have starved that process for visas, and it's not possible for somebody in Mexico, for instance, to come here easily to the United States. If you apply for a visa for your adult son or daughter in Mexico right now, the waiting time is 22 years.
Well, so, you know,
you could die waiting in that line there. On the other hand, a country like Denmark, from which hardly anybody is coming any longer because the standard of living in Denmark is higher than it is here, there is no waiting time. So, you know, the process isn't working well for us. At the same time, Peter, you know, one of the things that the article is really looking at is that enormous, enormous, enormous pressure is being put on people who live in Mexico to leave home. And that's the story of NAFTA. That's the story of what NAFTA did. And NAFTA, by allowing U.S. corn companies, for instance, to dump corn on the Mexican market, or meat companies like Smithfield to dump pork on the Mexican market. Well, when Smithfield began dumping pork on the Mexican market and Mexico's pork imports rose from 37,000 tons a year to 811,000 tons a year,
boy,
it cost Mexico 120,000 jobs of people who were basically working either as individual people raising and slaughtering pigs or working in small businesses in Mexico. When NAFTA allowed Cargill and Archer Daniels and Midland to dump corn on the Mexican market in order to take over the Mexican market in corn, Mexican corn prices dropped to a level that Mexican farmers, small farmers, could no longer sell their corn for a price that paid for the cost of growing it. That meant they had to do something to survive. They had to leave home.
Yeah, and I was going to say that so often the immigrants, the migrants, are reviled. On the other hand, they show some of the characteristics that Americans admire the most, and that is ambition. These are people that couldn't say, "Well, I'm going to leave my home, go to this strange land where you know I always have to worry about getting arrested, and I work for low wages, and I'm away from my family and my village and what have you." And so the idea that it's somehow that we've demonized them, I think, is certainly not looking at what is really occurring. The article that we're talking about was in the January 4th Nation magazine. It's by David Bacon, my guest, on the Peter Werby Show, How U.S. Policies Fueled Mexico's Great Migration. So I think that David has just answered the question that NAFTA, agreement to NAFTA, allowed Mexico to be flooded by corn from large American sellers that virtually wiped out the subsistence farmers in Mexico, and they said, "I have no income. Where's the money?" I always talk about that little cliche about follow the money. The money was north. And maybe, because then before we let our time slip away from us. You can tell us about more about your article and this Tar Heel, North Carolina facility, the world's largest pork slaughterhouse, owned by Smithfield Foods and Veracruz, and that virtual pipeline between the two cities. Tell us a little about that and your visit to Veracruz and Tar Heel.
Sure. Well, Smithfield also, in addition to dumping pork on the market in Mexico, Smithfield relocated its pig growing operations to a valley in Veracruz, and they set up 80 farms, each of which puts out 20,000 pigs a year for slaughter in order to basically feed the Mexican market, make money. The trouble with that is that growing pigs in that concentrated way creates an environmental catastrophe because the excrement and the urine from the pigs is kept in kind of lakes or what are called lagoons behind these farms. And so it produces, first of all, a horrible stench. And the article tells the story of a man, for instance, who lives next to one of these farms who has to put his family, his kids wake up at night vomiting from the smell. He has to put his family in his pickup truck and drive away from his farm until he gets far enough away from the smell that they can all sleep the rest of the night in the truck. The water gets contaminated. Flies start. They're everywhere. This is where the swine flu epidemic started, in that valley. So the thing about it, though, Peter, is that in that same period when Smithfield built that farm there, they were prohibited by the government of North Carolina from expanding any longer their pig farms in that state. So, and we know that North Carolina is a business-friendly state. So for North Carolina and a Republican governor to sign a bill basically forbidding Smithfield from building any more pig farms like that, you know that the situation has to be pretty drastic in North Carolina. So what Smithfield did essentially is they did in Mexico what they were not permitted to do any longer in the United States. That was NAFTA in operation. And people began leaving Veracruz, both because of that environmental problem and also because of the other economic pressures that we've been talking about here. And the number one state that people from Veracruz went to in the United States was North Carolina. And so people wound up getting jobs in that Smithfield packing plant because in the middle of the 1990s, Smithfield was looking for workers that they thought would just be passive people, people who wouldn't protest, people who would work at that really high line speed and low wages and not do anything about it. And at first, that was true. People were really scared, I think, when they went into that plant. But finally, the same conditions that other workers in that plant were protesting about, African Americans and Native Americans, were angry about, those Mexicans basically got angry at those same conditions and those same wages as well, too. And that's basically the reason why the people in that plant finally got together and brought the union in. But, you know, Smithfield, in many ways, it helped to produce that wave of migration into North Carolina by what it was doing in Mexico, by the farms that it built, by the economic pressure that it was putting on people there, was part of that NAFTA system. And then they took advantage of the flow of people that that produced by essentially trying to make money off of their low wages that they were paying them at his plant in Tar Heel.
One of the quotes, right at facts, the last quote in your article that was in The Nation magazine, How U.S. Policies Fueled Mexico's Great Migration, is from Roberto Ortega. He says, "We are fighting because we are being destroyed. That is the reason for the daily fight to try to change this." And that happening to a segment of the North American population suddenly has been expanded. And I think there's a realization that many of us, great numbers of us that never thought we'd be in that category, that we were being destroyed or that we had to fight every day to maintain what we thought was ours just as part of life, that this is now confronting so many of us. So in many ways, the people that are at the lowest rung have, using the same word, rang the bell for as a clarion call to what is going to occur to many more of us unless we do what he said, and that's a daily fight to try to change this.
That's right, and I think that's what the Occupy people are saying too, is that, you know, the 99% got to get together. You know, we have to stop, you know, thinking that we're enemies because we were born in different countries, or some of us came from one country and some of us didn't, or some of us are one race or some of us are not. Instead of looking at each other as being the problem here, we need to look at each other as being all part of that same 99% and really take a hard look at the people who are causing the problems for all of us here, because it's not, when we do that, it's not really hard to identify where the problems are coming from,
sure,
who the 1% are.
Well, there is an old slogan, and we either have to hang together or we're going to hang separately. David Bacon, I want to thank you for being on the broadcast. We haven't even touched on the wonderful penetrating photographs that David Bacon takes and accompanies his articles and are in his books. You can go to dbacon.igc.org. If that's too much, don't. If you're driving, you know, don't try to grab a piece of paper. You go to my website, Peter Werbe, W-E-R-B-E.com. There'll be a link there. David is working on a new book right now, The Right Not to Migrate. So we'll look forward to that, maybe do another follow-up interview. David Bacon, thanks for being on the Peter Werbe Show.
It was my pleasure, Peter.
Thank you for listening to Night Call on 101 WRIF. The views expressed on the program are not necessarily those of the staff, management, or ownership of WRIF Radio. Now, stay tuned for more Riff Rock on 101 WRIF Detroit. We'll be right back. now, more Riff Rock.
Come on, my friend, let's boogie.
On the Riff.
I'm not down with your exceptions. Get off my head.